Call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1 p.m. on Friday, April 6, 2018. Before we begin, I want to thank Christie Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Ben from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Kopp, Representative Reinbold, Representative Stutz, and myself, Representative Klayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Actually, I was wrong. You're not up first. Our first order of business today is House Bill 351, Juveniles Justice Facilities Treatment, sponsored by Representative Sponholz. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the bill is Judy Jensen, staff to Representative Sponholz, and Matt Davidson, Social Services Program Officer, Division of Juvenile Justice. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and then you may begin your presentation. And I would ask committee members, as is the practice, to save your questions until after the presentation and testimony.
Thank you. Through the chair, my name is Judy Jessen, staff to Representative Sponholz. I apologize. My boss would have loved to be here, but she's on a flight back to Anchorage to get ready for a constituent meeting happening this weekend.
Matt Davidson. I'm a Social Services Program Officer with the Division of Juvenile Justice.
House Bill 351 is a statutory cleanup bill, which updates the terms used to describe the facilities operated by the Division of Juvenile Justice and provides updated definitions for those terms. Current statutes contain references to facilities which DJJ does not operate and facilities that do not exist in the state of Alaska. The bill also makes a clear distinction between the role of juvenile probation officers and adult probation officers in places where the difference is unclear. HB 351 also requires staff of juvenile justice to be added to a list of mandatory reporters of child abuse and neglect. These updates are necessary to provide statutory clarity to ensure the division can manage its facilities effectively throughout the state. Currently, Alaska statutes reference places like work camps and juvenile detention homes, which are not recognized or operating in the state of Alaska. HB 351 adds juvenile treatment facility, juvenile detention facility, and temporary secure juvenile holding area as facilities currently being operated by the division and provides clear definitions for each of these terms. Because references to these facilities occur in many places in statute, this bill also touches upon many sections of statute. These changes are necessary to provide the clearest regulation over facilities in existence and operated by the DJJ. HB 351 also clarifies the role of juvenile and adult probation officers, first, by distinguishing clearly between the two, and second, by providing a clear definition for the term juvenile probation officer. These are meaningful changes to provide the best protection for juveniles in the custody of the Division of Juvenile Justice. Lastly, HB 351 adds DJJ staff to the list of mandatory reporters. It is the division's objective to engage in the rehabilitation of juvenile offenders. Adding DJJ staff to the list of mandatory reporters provides the best guarantee that when DJJ staff discover cases of child abuse and neglect, those cases are reported, investigated, and resolved for the best interest of the child. While these technical language updates touch many sections of statute, these language changes do not significantly alter the authority of the division over juveniles in its care. Rather, these updates protect juveniles by making it clear where juveniles can be placed and clearly defining the authority of DJJ, its staff, and facilities using current and relevant language. So I will take the quickest and clearest walk through the sectional that I can. It is a long sectional, but like I said before, these are mostly just updating terms and definitions. So we start in Section 1, which deals with the indemnity of civil liability for the actions of minors in state custody. It adds foster homes, a definition for reference for foster home, juvenile treatment facilities, juvenile detention facilities, and treatment institutions. Adds references for the division of juvenile treatment facility and juvenile treatment institution. What this functionally does is make sure that the people we're adding to the list are not responsible for any misconduct taken by juveniles who are under their care. Section 2 deals with sexual assault in the third degree by adding staff who work in juvenile detention facilities and juvenile treatment facilities to the definition of people who can who can engage in sexual assault in the third degree. Section 3 deals with sexual assault in the third degree as well by updating the definition of juvenile probation officer. Section 4 deals with sexual assault in the fourth degree by updating the definition of juvenile probation officer. Section 5 deals with crimes by legal guardians by adding employees of juvenile treatment institutions and juvenile and adult probation officers to the lists of people who can be legal guardians. Section 6 deals with crimes against persons committed by another person in a position of authority by adding correctional employees, juvenile facility staff, and staff members of juvenile treatment institutions as people who can have a position of authority over a person in their care. Section 7 deals with crimes against persons committed by a position in authority as well by adding definitions for juvenile facility staff and treatment institutions. Section 8 deals with orders to submit to DNA testing by clarifying that those who have been adjudicated delinquent may have to submit DNA samples. Section 9 deals with indecent viewing or photography, and it adds treatment institutions and juvenile treatment facilities to the list of places where it's not a crime if you see a juvenile in a state of undress. It also provides references for definitions of those terms. Section 10 deals with providing public education services by including juvenile detention facilities and juvenile treatment facilities as places where public education must be provided. Similarly, Section 11 deals with special education and includes juvenile treatment, includes treatment institutions, juvenile detention facilities, or juvenile treatment facilities as places where special education must be provided. It also adds references to definitions for those terms. Section 12 deals with medical marijuana by including juvenile treatment facilities as facilities operated by the state which are not required to provide medical marijuana. Section 13 deals with overtime for nurses by adding juvenile treatment facilities and institutions to describe facilities operated by the Division of Juvenile Justice. Section 14 deals with runaways and missing minors by updating the terms used to describe juvenile detention facilities operated by the DJJ and inappropriate emergency placement for minors. Section 15 also deals with runaways and missing minors by creating a new definition for temporary secure juvenile holding area where delinquent minors may be kept while they're awaiting transportation to a juvenile detention facility or pending a court order. Section 16 deals more with runaways and missing minors by updating the definition used to describe facilities operated by the Division of Juvenile Justice for temporary secure detention of minors. Section 17 deals with arrest procedures for juveniles by clarifying that the described duties apply to juvenile probation officers, not adult probation officers. It also updates language used to describe juvenile facilities and other areas where a delinquent minor may be held. Section 18 deals with the placement of minors who have an adjudication order by updating the terms of facilities where minors can be placed. Section 19 also deals with DNA submission for minors by adding a new subsection to clarify that minors 16 or older may be ordered to submit a DNA sample if adjudicated for certain crimes. Section 20 deals with placement of minors after the court commits them and before they are convicted by making conforming and clarifying amendments to the conditions under which a minor may be held in a facility that houses adult prisoners, and the language used to describe facilities operated by the Division of Juvenile Justice. Section 21 deals with temporary holding of minors while awaiting transport by updating the language used to describe conditions under which minors may be held in facilities housing adult prisoners, and also to update the language used to describe facilities operated by DJJ. Section 22 deals with parole officers arresting minors by clarifying that the authority to arrest a minor rests with juvenile, not adult probation officers. Section 23 deals with temporary detention and detention hearings by clarifying that the authority to detain a minor rests with juvenile, not adult probation officers. It also adds temporary secure juvenile holding areas to the list of approved places to hold juveniles. Section 24 deals with juvenile probation officers by updating the title and duties of a juvenile probation officer. Section 25 deals with notifying victims of crimes by clarifying that the department has a duty to notify victims when a minor is released from any court-ordered placement under AS 4712-120B1. Section 26 deals with public disclosure of information and department records relating to certain minors by correcting the language authorizing the department to disclose confidential information related to the offense when a minor has received an adjudication, rather than the offense the minor was alleged to have committed. Section 27, 28, and 29 deal with definitions of institutions. By amending the definition of juvenile detention facility in Section 27, amending the definition of minor for the purpose of these statutes in Section 28, and by creating new definitions for juvenile probation officer, juvenile treatment facility, residential child care facility, and temporary secure juvenile holding area. Section 30 deals with the powers of DHHS over DJJ by updating language used to describe juvenile facilities operated by the department. Section 31 deals with the duties of the department related to the custody of minors by updating the language used to describe the facilities operated by the department. Section 32 deals with the authority to maintain and operate facilities by updating the language used to describe places the department can operate juvenile facilities to reflect the diversity of Alaskan communities and entities, such as the need for airports that operate the temporary secure juvenile holding areas. Section 33 deals with the operations of homes and facilities. It repeals and reenacts language to update the language used to describe juvenile facilities. Section 34 deals with the operations of homes and facilities as well by updating language to reflect the diversity of Alaskan communities that may be authorized to operate juvenile detention facilities. Section 35 deals with social services and institutions definitions by updating the definition of juvenile detention facilities. Section 36 deals with social services, institutions, and definitions as well by updating the definitions of minor for the purpose of these statutes. Section 37 deals with social services, institutions, and definitions by adding new definitions for juvenile probation officer, juvenile treatment facility, and temporary secure juvenile holding area. Section 38 deals with mandatory reporting and neglect. This is the section that adds juvenile probation officers, office staff, and staff of juvenile facilities to the list of mandatory reporters. Section 39 is where the repealers are. It repeals the revocation of juvenile driver's licenses for offenses involving a controlled substance that were handled informally by the division. It also repeals the definitions for the terms that are no longer in use, such as juvenile detention home, juvenile work camp, and treatment facility. Section 40 is the applicability section. Section 41 authorizes the department to adopt regulations to implement these changes, and Section 42 is the effective date.
Thank you very much. Did Mr. Davidson have a presentation as part of it, or are you more here for questions?
I'm here for questions, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you very much. I do want to at least get an opportunity for public hearing if there's anyone that wants to testify, so I'm going to go around the committee to see if anyone has questions. I'll give each member one opportunity to ask a series of up to three questions, and then we'll move on to the next committee member. Are there questions from the committee? Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
that was almost a non-question.
I had the opportunity to go through this with the bill sponsor earlier, and they answered a number of my questions at that time. If you're not planning to move it today, I would just plan to study it further, but I don't have any.
We're not going to move the bill today. Questions? Representative Reinbold?
It's a comment, but I just wanted to say thank you for answering our questions. They did meet with us ahead of time, and it was a pleasant courtesy and a rare thing that happens these days. So I just want to say thank you.
Through the chair, it was our pleasure, and thank you for the time to go through this.
All right. I don't see any other questions from the committee. I would like to open for public and invited testimony on House Bill 351. First, is there anyone in the room that would like to provide testimony on House Bill 351? Hearing and seeing no one, is there anyone online? I see Sean Owens from the Division of Juvenile Justice. He's online for questions. Is there? And I don't see anyone else online, so seeing no one online or in the room that wants to provide testimony, we will close the public hearing. And I would just note, I'm going to be setting an amendment deadline for amendments to House Bill 351 Either it will either be Tuesday next week at 4 p.m. or Wednesday next week at 4 p.m. We will announce later today by email which of those dates will be the deadline for amendments. And so watch your emails, because there's definitely going to be an amendment deadline if you have amendments to 351. And other than that, at this time, we'll hold the bill for further review. That brings us to our second and final order of business this afternoon, House Joint Resolution 38, Alaska Railroad Transfer Act and Conveyances, sponsored by Representative Kopp. This is the first hearing of the joint resolution in the Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the resolution is Representative Kopp and his staff, Eric Cordero Giorgana. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and then you may begin your presentation. As is the practice in this committee, we will hold questions until after your presentation is over. And Representative Kopp, I'd asked you to communicate with your staff earlier that you ought to keep your presentation to 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Chuck Kopp, District 24.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you and committee members for allowing us to present what we feel is undoubtedly the most important piece of property rights legislation in front of this legislative body this session. And Mr. Chairman, this is within this legislature's purview to weigh in on this matter, as the Alaska Railroad Corporation, is an instrumentality of the state and properly subject to our oversight and guidance. Mr. Chairman, the purpose of this resolution is targeted at recent Alaska Railroad claims to an exclusive use easement conveyed over property patented to others, largely homestead patents, Mr. Chairman, more than 200 of them, where the United States did not conclusively hold that interest in the right-of-way at the time of the transfer from federal to state ownership in 1983. Now, by way of a little history, before we move on, the Alaska Railroad Act of 1914 is what put the standard railroad easement across the nearly 500 miles of track in Alaska. So what is the standard railroad easement? It is for rail, telegraph, and telephone, and above-ground co-located utilities. This was the initially reserved limited interest easement. And today, this limited interest right-of-way provides the foundation for approximately 80% of all railroad track in America. The reason why that is the case is because Congress in 1875 stopped allowing any fee simple interest ownership in right-of-way for railroads. They had initially allowed fee simple interest ownership to incentivize the east-west route across the United States, but the litigious history of that showed that there was a lot of problems involved with railroads charging outrageous fees, blocking landowners from accessing the crossing to get to the other side, mostly with ranchers at the time, and then later with homesteaders as we expanded west. And the denial of shared use of the right-of-way in any capacity led to Congress saying, no more are we giving fee simple interest ownership in the General Railroad Act of 1875. You have a surface easement only, an easement to cross other people's property. This was what our Interior Board of Land Appeals relied on in 1982 when Alaska was making its statehood land claims properly under our statehood compact. And some of the claims our state made was to right-of-way along the railroad track. And the railroad said, you can't select this. This has already been appropriated or reserved to us. We own it, state. You can't select it. Under your yellow tab, committee members, in your book here, your yellow tab, the 1982 Interior Board of Land Appeals, in their ruling on this case, flip to it in my book here, went directly to the 1875 Act, showing how it was directly connected to the 1914 Alaska Railroad Act, and said the General Railroad Right-of-Way Act of March 3, 1875, granting a similar right-of-way for railroad across public lands outside Alaska, has been held to convey only an easement and not a fee interest in the land. And the Interior Board of Land Appeals relied on the 1875 case, saying, railroad, you don't have a fee simple interest. Therefore, the state can select Alaska Railroad right-of-way in its statehood land selection. And they lost the case, and Alaska was able to make those landhood selections. The reason why? The law was clear. The law was clear. The railroad did not have a fee simple interest in the right-of-way. They had only a surface easement only. They concluded in that decision, saying these cases under other railroad right-of-way statutes, and they list several more, persuade us that the lands embraced in the impellent right-of-way should not be considered to be appropriated or reserved at the time of state selection, so has to be excluded therefrom. So the decision held that a right-of-way for railroad shall be reserved in any state selection passion issued is correct. So the state was able to make those selections of state land and reserve the 1914 standard easement. So what's the harm? Hundreds of landowners along the Alaska Railroad Corporation's right-of-way have had property rights confiscated and a cloud put on their title through an unlawful exclusive use easement claim the Alaska Railroad makes to the entire right-of-way. So, Mr. Chairman, on that point, the entire right-of-way is over 470 miles of track. Hundreds of miles of that right-of-way has gone into private ownership over the years from 1914 up until 1983 when it was transferred to the state. That means that everybody with a homestead patent during that time, these are people who had received their 160-acre homestead patent from the federal government, and they had what's called a federal patent, a deed to the land where the federal government totally divested themselves of ownership, and it had the federal government never claimed or exercised an exclusive use easement on that private property. It was considered a right-of-way. Nobody disputed that, but the underlying landowner was still the homesteaders. So, Mr. Chairman, that claim to the entire right-of-way is one that brings us before this body, because some of the things that drove that claim were highlighted in a letter that the railroad wrote in 2014 to a constituent of mine, a Mr. John Pletcher in South Anchorage. And they say, and I think the committee might find this shocking, the letter is in your packet. It says that regardless of what the federal government's interest is in the right-of-way, the obligation exists, regardless of what the United States owned at the time, to transfer this exclusive use easement to the entire right-of-way. So, we don't care what the federal government owned. They could still transfer this interest to the state, even if they didn't own it. This is their attorney saying this, Mr. Chairman. That's on page 8 of that letter. Also, the railroad outright ownership to the entire strip of land for all 470 miles of the right-of-way. And Mr. Chairman, this has to be squared with the Marvin Brandt revocable trust decision, where the Supreme Court in 2014 reaffirmed that railroads have surface easements only. And when those easements are no longer being used, they revert to the underlying landowner, in this case, Mr. Brandt, when the railroad stopped using that easement. The railroad will tell you that there is no connection. But, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Copper, could you tell us, we've got a big book here, I'm just trying to figure out where the letter is that you're referencing.
The yellow tab was the 1982 IBLA case. The letter from, this was passed out earlier. Okay, is that tabbed? Okay. Apparently the letter is not tabbed in the booklet, but I have a copy of it here. I believe it is in the booklet, Mr. Chairman, but I have a copy here for the committee. Thank you. Yes.
Sorry for the interruption.
No, that's very good. Thank you, Lizzie. Yeah. So, Mr. Chairman, the second point is that HJR 38 addresses a violation of state statute where in 2005 and 2006 the railroad circumvented required legislative approval by applying for and receiving from the Bureau of Land Management, which is in the Department of Interior, land patents within a municipality, specifically Anchorage, that overlaid original homestead federal land patents that go all the way through the core of Anchorage. And they also run, Mr. Chairman, all the way up through the valley, going up toward Talkeetna and on. Mr. Chairman, the railroad's position is they didn't have to ask the legislature for this because the exclusive use easement was the federal government's to give to the railroad. But, Mr. Chairman, the railroad is accountable to state law, and the state says you do have to come ask for us before you can accept or receive such a grant. Further, Mr. Chairman, the law is very clear that an exclusive use easement was never contemplated in the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act to be considered across all 470 miles of track, but only in areas where the federal government actually owns such an easement, like in the Denali Borough, and in areas where there was federal land among contested Native Corporation land claims. Next slide. So what does HJR 38 do? It provides legislative approval for the Alaska Railroad or the governor to disclaim unlawfully acquired property by the state. Disclaim means we're not touching that property interest because we consider it a hot interest, a possibly a stolen interest. And so we walk away from that because we do not want to incur liability to the state by making a property interest claim that the state does not lawfully have. The second thing HJR 38 does is it directs that if a property interest was not available to the railroad under federal law and ownership, then it certainly is not available to the Alaska Railroad now. The final thing it does, Mr. Chairman, is it calls upon our congressional delegation to help resolve claims to the right-of-way as a result of misapplication of the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act. And our congressional delegation has been helpful and responsive as a result of this effort. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What does HJR 38 not do? It does not remove the Alaska Railroad Corporation's ability and duty to police and keep tracks and right-of-way safe, affect their speeds, etc. Mr. Chairman, the Alaska Railroad has put out a narrative and encourage people to say that if HJR 38 passes, they will have to reduce speeds and possibly not meet schedule commitments. Mr. Chairman, nothing could be further from the truth. The Alaska Railroad has operated with a standard railroad easement, what Governor Hammond said under the Memorandum of Understanding in 1983 that he signed was the 1914 standard railroad easement would be the easement for all future expansion of the railroad. They have been moving jet fuel under this easement. They have been moving all manner of hazardous materials under that right-of-way easement. And, Mr. Chairman, 80% of the railroad tracks in America operate under the same easement. Only pre-1875 railroads have fee simple title. So nearly every operational railroad today does not have exclusive use easement, none that I know of. Secondly, Mr. Chairman, what this does not do is it does not affect any lawfully obtained property, including any right, title, or interest which passed from federal to state ownership in 1983. Finally, Mr. Chairman, this resolution does not impact the railroad's ability to profit or its economic model. I want our railroad to be successful. But for them to come and tell you that they have to run a train at 20 miles per hour across 100 miles of homestead land because of the possibility that something might happen, Mr. Chairman, right now the railroad has full authority to stop anything in the right-of-way that is dangerous. They've always had that authority, and HJR 38 will not affect their ability to get an injunction on any interfering or competing use of the right-of-way like they have always been able to do since 1923 when the railroad was completed. Next slide. Mr. Chairman, I briefly touched on this slide, the Alaska Railroad Act. The federal government owned and operated the railroad and some of the land over which the railroad operated, but there was much railroad right-of-way that had passed into private hands that was in non-federal ownership, because we know that many of our citizens received homestead patents. When those patents included land crossed by the railroad, the federal government still transferred ownership of the land to the citizen, but reserved for itself a specific property interest called the right-of-way, so it could use 100 feet on either side for the rail, telegraph, and telephone. Next slide. The railroad right-of-way gave the railroad a right to use the land owned by others, as identified in each federal patent, but it did not transfer a right to own and control the property in a matter unrelated to the reservation. And we've already talked about the distinction between fee, simple title, and other railroads. Next slide. The federal government, again, Mr. Chairman, cannot transfer a property interest to the state of Alaska if it never owned the property interest in the first place. So what is a standard railroad easement? It is not fee, simple ownership of land, or necessarily the right to exclusivity. It is an interest in land that is owned by other people, usually limited in the extent of occupancy and use otherwise. It can involve a general or specific portion of the property. And we now know that after 1875, this was the limited interest that Congress has allowed all railroads to have after that. So the rail properties granted to the state include only the right title and interest, which belonged to the United States in 1983. Mr. Chairman, other than in the Denali Borough and on a few other federal parcels of land, there was no outright exclusive use that was related in ARTA to other areas. It was only where the federal government actually possessed that interest. The exclusive use easement we're talking about allows the holder to exclude all others, including to fence, bar off at their discretion, any other user of the land, whether that use is a safety issue or not. As I have said, there is no question the railroad did have an exclusive use in Denali National Park and an area subject to unresolved native claims, that because that was the federal government that owned that property and they had it. But due to a fundamental misreading of ARTA, Mr. Chairman, the Alaska Railroad claims that at least an exclusive use easement must be granted to the state in the entire right-of-way, again, regardless of what the federal interest was in the right-of-way over private property. And this is what they stated in the letter to Mr. Pletcher. So I would just say that no credible argument can be made that an exclusive use easement belongs to the Alaska Railroad without establishing what the private parties and the federal government actually owned in 1983. Mr. Chairman, in 1996, Phyllis Johnson, who was legal counsel for the railroad, said as such. She said, the railroad, might not have owned all we thought we had owned, and that we have to do a parcel-by-parcel search to know what the property interests were before we came along. But something happened after 1996 where current legal counsel has gotten away from that, and because, frankly, it's easier to claim that you don't have to do a parcel-by-parcel research, that an entire exclusive use easement was given to the right-of-way, even if you can't prove through our title recording system. That is, it's easy for the railroad, but it's wholly foisted on our innocent property owners along the track, and that claim has been made without notice or recourse for them to contest otherwise. So the resolution itself, Mr. Chairman, just says the legislature believes, as it pertains to privately held properties in the state that contain or are required to contain a reservation for the purposes set out in the railroad, that these conveyances that purport to convey an exclusive use easement, if it was not conclusively owned by the federal government at the time of transfer, these are contrary to law. These are common sense statements, Mr. Speaker. They should not even be controversial. This is common property law. Any right, title, or interest not conclusively owned by the federal government at the time of the transfer, if it was erroneously conveyed to the railroad corporation without the legislative approval required under state statute, then this should be disclaimed as a matter of law. And finally, Mr. Chairman, this states that the legislature urges our Alaska delegation in Congress to recognize the views of the legislature expressed in this resolution and to take appropriate action. Mr. Chairman, the supporters of this resolution include nearly every land title, Association of Realtors in Alaska. Alaska Association of Realtors, the Anchorage Association of Realtors, the Municipality of Anchorage passed a unanimous resolution supporting this. Other property owners, native corporations listed up here with land, dealing with land and resource management along the tracks, many community councils and businesses and private property owners along the right-of-way. Mr. Chairman, many property owners have spoken out. There's a few of these quotes in your packet, but the denial of access to their own property and the cloud this has put on their title, particularly in 2005 and 2006 when Department of Interior land patents were issued over on top of federal homestead patents without notification to the landowners, people realized, much to their chagrin, beginning in 2012, when the residential right-of-way use permit program was being rolled out to bite down on the exclusive use claim, that they in fact had a land patent overlaid on their homestead patent. And so imagine having a land patent for 50 years and all of a sudden you have a federal patent overlaid making a claim that was never issued before. So Mr. Speaker, in conclusion, or Mr. Chairman, in conclusion,
I'm ready for that elevation.
I would ask the committee to listen to the testimony of the people that are additional folks who are waiting to comment on this. I have a lot more I could say, but I'll save that for closing, Mr. Chairman, after others. Go ahead.
Through the chair, Eric, contains a sample of a homestead patent and a current put on top of it, so you can review it. Thank you, sir.
That was Eric Cordero. Mr. Cordero, next time be sure to identify yourself. So,
I did.
Okay, she didn't hear. All right, we'll start to see if anyone on the committee has questions. We actually have from the railroad is here with invited testimony. They'll get an equal opportunity to be heard. But questions for Representative Kopp or his staff before we get to the next. Representative Stutzen, we'll do the same routine. Everybody's got one shot, three questions.
Thank you. I think I only have one question at this point. Who's paying the property taxes on this property?
I don't know if the railroad pays property taxes on the right-of-way or not. You'd have to ask them. I do know that in South Anchorage, specifically in the Ocean View neighborhood, that's a point of contention because the size of the lot includes the right-of-way. And that has been brought out by owners in the Flying Crown neighborhood. Whether that right-of-way should be taxed or not is a separate issue, but they've been pointed out that their lot size goes over into the right-of-way.
Representative Stutz.
Thank you. So current.
There wasn't one.
I know. I didn't need until he gave me the answer.
It's okay.
So currently the property tax on that right-of-way?
I do. Where it does go into the right-of-way where they're being assessed values, yes.
Thank you.
Any further questions for the bill sponsor or the resolution sponsor? I don't see any. So that will bring us to invited and public testimony on House Joint Resolution 38. I'll open public and invited testimony. And the first two folks that we'll have up are two folks from the railroad, and I'll let you guys choose who speaks first. And in the world of equal time, I've advised the railroad representatives that Representative Kopp got 20 minutes, and that each of these gentlemen gets 10 minutes each. We run a tight ship here in judiciary.
We appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill O'Leary. I am the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Railroad. I'm here today representing the 600 employees, numerous customers, and 500,000 passengers that we carry every year. And on their behalf, I'm here in opposition to House Joint Resolution 38. There are a number of reasons we oppose HJR 38, but they fall into two primary categories, and the first being safety, the second being legal issues. I want to talk today about why safety necessitates that we have that exclusivity in the right-of-way and the impacts to the railroad and our customers should we not have that exclusive right-of-way. I'd then like to have Andy Berend, the Alaska Railroad's chief counsel, discuss many of the legal issues raised by this resolution that have been brought up in previous testimony. Additionally, we have Brian Lindemood, Alaska Railroad's vice president of engineering, and Doug Stevens, Alaska Railroad's manager of land services, both online to answer in depth any questions the committee may have. So there's one opening comment I can make. You know, as was noted in past discussions by members of this committee, by members of the House State Affairs Committee, and also by several members of the Anchorage Assembly recently, this is an issue that belongs in court. When it comes to a situation where reasonable people disagree about the nuances of a law, of a point of law, a court of law is where the decision on that point of law should be made. With that as my opener, I'd like to transition over to safety quickly. Very simply put, safety is the Alaska Railroad's top priority. We don't take safety as seriously as they should. The number of fatalities, YouTube videos shot on railroad tracks every day, every year, bears that out. Every year, nearly 500 people are killed in this country trespassing on railroad property. Time and time again, people either do not consider or vastly underestimate the dangers to themselves and to others of when they trespass onto railroad rights-of-way, drive around gates at crossings, or put structures such as swimming or hot tubs in right-of-way. 14 people have been killed trespassing on the Alaska Railroad since transfer in 1985, including a 23-year-old woman since the last hearing we had on this resolution. Every single one of those deaths was avoidable. Loss of exclusive control of the right-of-way can be detrimental to the operations of the railroad, our customers, our passengers, our business partners, and the people of Alaska who are the ultimate owners of the Alaska Railroad. As it is now, we can assume control in all areas of our right-of-way and assume our professionally trained security personnel, track managers, maintenance crews, onboard personnel, just to name a few, are making sure the tracks and the right-of-way are clear, safe, and operational. We have full control and discretion to remove anything and everything that poses a safety hazard to our operations. If the right-of-way is turned into a checkerboard of control from Seward to Fairbanks, we can't make that assumption. We may find it necessary to reduce track speeds where in those areas that we don't have complete control. If we have one parcel that is not under our control along miles-long stretch of track, we may have to reduce our speeds along that entire stretch, making it impossible to meet our commitments, get passengers to wherever they're going, Fairbanks, Denali, and or freight in a timely and economical manner. This resolution also brings up who could control what goes in the right-of-way. Can our neighbors store junked cars leaking oil, which has happened, on the right-of-way? Can they plow snow berms up so that people approaching or stopped at railroad crossings can't see an oncoming train? Can they store hazardous materials on the right-of-way? Can we tell our neighbors to remove a swing set 30 feet from the tracks or remove it ourselves if they refuse to? Remember, our train cars are 80 feet long. In case of a derailment, having a 100-foot buffer on each side of the track is critical. Or we have to take our neighbors to court every single time they are doing something unsafe. Now, what about what do we allow actually in the right-of-way? If our neighbors disagree with public trail in the right-of-way, like the Coastal Trail, the Fish Creek Trail we've been working with the Municipality of Anchorage and Turnagain Community Council on, can they stop the community from building a trail? Something specifically allowed for in state law? Can they stop a gas pipeline, electric line, highway or street that might use the right-of-way? Can they demand outrageous parking, the small section of the right-of-way? This ambiguity could tie up projects for years, if not decades, or kill them altogether because of the questions of ownership. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for your time and for hearing this today. You know, respectfully, this resolution incorrectly describes the rights held by the federal government in the Alaska Railroad right-of-way. It misinterprets the property rights the government transferred to the state of Alaska and the court cases regarding rights-of-way, railroad rights-of-way. I again would like to state that this is an issue for the courts to decide and determine the legal answer. I encourage you not to support House Joint Resolution 38. Thank you.
I'll see if anyone has questions for Mr. O'Leary before we go to the other invited testimony from the railroad. Representative Eastman, we're going the same round. Everybody gets three questions. Go ahead.
Mine will be brief. my family and I were a passenger on the railroad within the last year, and I don't remember at any time during our trip or afterwards the railroad asking us any of our thoughts on this matter. Customarily, you would either get permission or at least get some idea of a on their behalf in a committee. So as someone who does support this legislation, I ask that you not speak on my behalf or other passengers that you haven't talked to.
Sounds like a comment, not a question. Any other questions?
This one, you guys know this is a quagmire right now. I mean, it's a tough situation because I'm getting information on both sides. So I guess I'm just going to pose questions in regards to traditional homestead use. This would probably bother me if I had a homestead along here. And so if you could just address traditional homestead use, recreation, and why wouldn't you want legislative approval when it's a state corporation? I mean, those are kind of the red flags for me right now.
And before you answer that, I want to recognize that actually Representative Christ Tompkins probably joined us 30 minutes ago, and I didn't recognize his coming in, and Representative Ledoux just joined us. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. O'Leary.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I'm not sure I fully understand it's the question. I mean, our concern is with our ability to operate a safe railroad in and have exclusive control of the right-of-way. I'm sorry, I don't.
Okay. So basically, that's obvious. Okay, we all know that. We all want safety. However, it seems like there's been a lot of safety over the years, and there's been collaboration with the traditional homestead users, the traditional, I know there's churches and things that along there that recreate in that area that have called me. And, of course, us as legislators, you know, want to have some input. So it's basically three questions wrapped into one. But how do you deal with the traditional users that have been there before you were there and those that recreate along there and think of public use, in addition to addressing why in the world would we as legislators not want to participate in this type of issue?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I think you know, this is something that
you should identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Again, Bill O'Leary with the CEO of the railroad here. You know, we are not opposed to you know, people recreating around. We understand we bisect this state to a large degree, and we understand that it's, you know, we're a big operating entity. Our primary concern, again, I keep harking back to that, is our safety issues out there and the issues about being able to run an economical railroad in the situation. So again, I don't think I've got a great answer for you here and on this, because I'm not clear that I'm fully getting the question. I apologize for that.
Want to try chair? Again, Representative?
Yeah, please.
We're trying to make sure that we're good neighbors, okay? I'll give you an example. I have a correctional facility in my neighborhood right now. And sadly, the commissioner, Dean Williams, just put a bunch of male prisoners in that female prison. They have been a good neighbor for many, many years. They've put murderers in there and a bunch of people that we object to. Our community council passed a resolution against that. They are not being good neighbors. They are not addressing our concerns, and that's why I have a red flag with this. I think the railroad needs to be a good neighbor. There's traditional uses that were historic far before you. There are churches and things that recreate in the area. We can't help if there's suicide. I don't know what all these 14, you know, different incidences since 1982 were, but, you know, and I would sure like to see, you know, if they were suicide or not or whatever. I'm not sure whose problem they were. But the bottom line is I think as a state, we need to lead by example and be good collaborative neighbors and not just go and impose our rights over the traditional rights of others. So that's basically.
Okay. And again, Bill O'Leary with the Alaska Railroad, through the chair, Representative Reinbold. I mean, our desire is to be a good neighbor. I mean, we're very, very clear about that. And I think there have been situations in the past where the railroad, for right or for wrong, has been painted with not being a good neighbor. I will tell you that it is important to me as the leader of this organization, it's important to our board that we do work collaboratively and well with
many different organizations, whether it's municipalities, whether it's neighbors, whether it's whoever may be out there. But there are certain things that for us to run a safe operation, we have to draw the line on. And that's very similar to, I think, airports want to be good neighbors and things like that. But, again, those are all fenced off. Nobody can go out on the tarmac and do different things out there to recreate on them. So it's like anything else in life. It's finding that balance that's out there.
Okay. Can I?
Follow-up? Second
question. So basically, the airport is a very small area. It's not 470 miles or whatever you guys said it was. The railroad is right through a lot of traditional use property, traditional recreation areas. And so that's where my concern is. I would like to know, if you said there was 14, I would like to know, were those railroad fault that they hit something? Was that suicide? What was the 14? And are there areas where signage and things can put up so to reduce the danger, if you're claiming that there's danger, just signage and awareness, fees imposed if they're violated, while still the traditional uses such as homesteads, recreational areas, et cetera, are still allowed to have their use, or even people that are paying property taxes?
Through the chair, Representative Reinhold, again, Bill O'Leary here. Our position is that the 14 people, and I don't know the specifics of all of them, but I will tell you that they were trespassing on the railroad when they were killed.
I think you can have a follow-up. I just, for clarity, my understanding, but Mr. O'Leary can correct me if I'm wrong, I think the most recent death, the woman was asleep on the tracks at night, and they, by the time they saw her, it was too late to stop. And I don't know. I mean, that's all I know about the most recent one. Representative Reinbold, third question.
Well, 500 miles or whatever is a long swath between critical habited areas, you know, from Fairbanks down. I mean, it's a big area. And I guess my thing is, I just want us to be good, respectable neighbors that honor historic traditions and, you know, while still maintaining safety. So I really do. I'm not sure where I stand on one side or the other on this resolution at right now, but I can tell you that I want to honor traditional uses, and I want to honor recreation, and I do think, as legislators with oversight, that we should. So to me, it sounds like a reasonable resolution. And if someone's just trespassing, I mean, it just seems like that's not in and of itself, you know, on an easement, because you could say we're trespassing all the time when we're going around. We're in utility easements. I've been building trails for years and years, and we're allowed on those right-of-ways, and I have to collaborate with all my community councils and with all the multi-user groups, and it's a lot of work. And to just come and say, this is ours, it's exclusive use, it just seems harsh to me. So,
Representative Reinbold, I didn't hear a question, but I'll see that as a fairly clear comment. Other questions for Mr. O'Leary? Representative Christ-Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about the number of fatalities you described. Mr. O'Leary, did you say 14 fatalities within the railroad right away since the transfer in 84 or whatever it was?
Through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins, correct. 14 fatalities on the Alaska Railroad since transfer in 1985.
Okay. Thank you. And my second question relates, you mentioned cars being 80 or 90 feet long, and is it your belief that the railroad needs to manage the right-of-way for a hypothetical that at any point along the right-of-way, a car might derail and go entirely perpendicular to the tracks and wipe out everything, and that the railroad has to prepare for every inch of the right-of-way, there might be a train car just sort of snow plowing along, and that everything needs to be removed from those margins along the tracks? I'm trying to better understand mm-hmm. the context of your comment.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins, again, Bill O'Leary with the railroad. You know, from our perspective, we have 100 feet on either side of the track, or the center line of the track at this point as a right-of-way. And from a pure safety perspective, yes, I would say that we, you know, would like to protect that right-of-way very seriously, because we think that is something that can happen. It has something that has happened. And again, you know, rail cars or trains, when they do derail, heavy freight trains can take up to a mile to stop, so they can cut quite a swath of damage and destruction out there. So that is, I think, the primary or a of the right of way out there, and is very important to us from that regard.
Thank you. And my last question, I'm from Southeast, so I'm not as familiar with railroad history as perhaps the rest of the committee, but in Alaska, just in Alaska, not talking about Lower 48, but in Alaska, has anything like that happened in which there's been a derailment and a train car has cut this height swath of destruction, as you just noted, wiping out property, or has a derailment resulted in anyone dying in Alaska railroad history?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Thompson, again, Bill O'Leary, I am not sure has there anyone been killed in the right-of-way as a result of a derailment. My initial response is that has not occurred, but I'd have to get back to you on that. I will tell you that there have been derailments, as with every railroad over the years, and there have been some very serious, I mean, some would say sort of horrific derailments in the past, and it's something that we take very seriously.
Thank you.
Representative Suits.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm looking at this letter here from Petro Star that wrote on behalf of the Alaska Railroad Corporation, and in it they say denying exclusive right-of-way will impede from developments to connect Anchorage to the interior. I'm failing to see how, by you not having the exclusive right-of-way, that would impede the development. Can you speak to that at all?
Through the chair, it's again Bill O'Leary with the Alaska Railroad. From the Alaska Railroad's perspective, I couldn't tell you exactly what Petrostar is referring to, but from the Alaska Railroad's perspective, I mean, we move freight between Anchorage and Fairbanks and throughout the state along the rail line here. And our perspective, without having exclusive control of the right-of-way, what we need to know what's around that next corner. And I think our Vice President of Engineering, Brian Lindemood, is on the line. He's representing our operating group today and could speak to that if you'd like. But it is important for us to run a safe economical railroad that we are in control of that right-of-way. And if we're not in control of that right-of-way, and there could very easily be operational impacts. And as it stands right now, we are... You know, that could, again, impact the economics of what the Alaska Railroad can do safely.
Okay. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. O'Leary. Mr. O'Leary, you originally were talking about having to take property owners to court to resolve differences. Can you tell me when the last time the railroad had to go to court to resolve something they couldn't work out with the property owner?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, again, Bill O'Leary, I refer to legal counsel here, but I'm not clear. We had to do that of late.
May I introduce you? Yes. Mr. Chair and the committee, this is Andy Barron. I'm the chief counsel at the Alaska Railroad. I'm not aware of any court action that actually occurred. There have been, since I've been at the railroad, which is almost 8 years now, I can think of at least three situations where there were commercial entities who were using the right-of-way without permission, without a permit to do so, for their own business. And we engaged with them, discussed with them the fact that they needed to get their business out of the right-of-way. In one case, there were junk cars that were leaking oil. In fact, ADEC had to get involved in that one. And in those three cases, we went down to the courthouse steps, you might say. Those entities did not cooperate with removing their materials from the right-of-way. We sent several cease and desist types of letters, demand letters, and in fact drafted complaints, which we said, you know, if you're not out in 30 days, we're going to file this complaint. All three did leave. But as far as a residential property owner, I'm not aware of any court actions that we've taken.
Okay.
Follow up?
So since HJR 38 primarily deals with homestead patent areas, which are primarily residential, would it be fair to say that it's a very rare occurrence when the court has to get involved to resolve something? Would that be fair to say?
Chair, Representative Kopp.
ID again.
Excuse me. This is Andy Behrend. I'm the Chief Counsel, Alaska Railroad. I would say that it has been rare. I would say that, and this goes to some extent to Representative Reinbold's questions, that we have actually worked with residential landowners. There was an attempt to put together a residential use policy and a permit policy. It was passed by our board. That was was controversial, and that's been rescinded. But generally speaking, I think we have occasionally had some issues with things like if there's overwatering that can create a drainage problem or an erosion problem in the right-of-way. We've talked to people and generally worked it out. So when we're talking about going to court, what I'm thinking of is if we have, and I think we do have, and I'll talk about it a little bit, if there is a legal dispute about the property rights, then the courts are the right place to answer those questions. But as far as actual residential uses of the right-of-way, we do our best to work through those. And we have, with respect to Representative Reinbold, you mentioned that there were, through the chair, Representative Reinbold, that there were situations where residential uses, homestead uses were made where they were there before we were. In fact, in a lot of these situations, including in Anchorage, the main line has been there, the Federal Railroad has been there since 1920 through to 1923 when the full railroad was completed. And so, but even despite that, we have worked with residents. There are residential uses in the right-of-way. We did make an attempt to regulate those uses, which is something that what we contend is our right, the exclusive use easement allows. It's a mechanism where we can, at our, as you mentioned, Representative Kopp, at our discretion, we can regulate what goes on.
Just one more follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Last one, Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So thank you, Mr. Behrend, for that answer. With HGR 38 basically simply saying that the current understanding of a standard railroad easement, which the railroad hasn't asserted more than that before 2012 in any widespread way, is your fear that by continuing a standard railroad easement understanding that landowners will suddenly rise up with new and unsettling behavior that will threaten the safety and very existence of the railroad?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, again, Bill O'Leary. We don't know what HJR 38 means, but we can see issues with it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'm the only one that hasn't asked questions. So I have just a couple. It's actually a follow-up on Representative Stute's earlier question. So in South Anchorage, where you've got homeowners that are, and probably in Eagle River too, homeowners that are adjacent or just property owners, not just home, could be business properties, that are adjacent to the railroad, and the railroad has easement over those properties. How are the property taxes being dealt with? Does the railroad pay any property taxes on those easements, and how does the easement affect the property valuation that's paid to the municipality, if you know?
Mr. Chairman, again, Bill O'Leary. The Alaska Railroad, as an instrumentality of the state, as brought up earlier, is a tax-exempt entity, so we are exempt from such taxes.
But I wanted to make sure.
No. It's my understanding that I am unaware of any part of the right-of-way that is currently that adjacent homeowners are paying property taxes on.
Okay. I don't see any other questions, so we will next go to Mr. Berend. I know you may have had questions that presage what you're going to say, but I'll give you a chance to make your testimony as well. And similar to Mr. O'Leary, I'll give you 10 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Berend, and I am the chief counsel at the Alaska Railroad, and I appreciate the opportunity to follow up Mr. O'Leary's testimony to touch on some of the key legal issues that are raised by House Joint Resolution 38. The proponents of HJR 38 assert that the federal government transferred exclusive rights to the Alaska right-of-way that the federal government did not own, and they further assert that the Alaska Railroad right-of-way is a non-exclusive easement that adjoining landowners can use in any manner that does not interfere with railroad operations. These assertions are incorrect. The Alaska Railroad does have exclusive control of its right-of-way, and this is true for several reasons. First, as Congress expressly found when it was considering the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act in 1982, the federal government owned most of the Alaska Railroad right-of-way in fee simple title, which it acquired as a result of the 1914 Congressional Act that created the Alaska Railroad. Second, as specifically guaranteed in the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act, which I'll call ARTA for short, the federal government transferred at least an exclusive use easement in all of the Alaska Railroad right-of-way to the state-owned railroad in 1985. Third, even if the Alaska Railroad had not received fee simple title or an exclusive use easement in the right-of-way, railroad easements have been consistently held by the courts for well over 100 years to provide railroads with exclusive rights in the right-of-way. Now, we have supplied a memorandum to the committee that explores these issues, and I don't have time to go into all of those issues in depth, but I did want to hit on some of the most important ones. The origins of the Alaska Railroad's exclusive rights and its right-of-way trace to the Act of March 12, 1914, which authorized and directed the location and construction and operation of a railroad route in the territory of Alaska. And this is what the 1914 Act says. The railroad route was, quote, to provide transportation of coal for the Army and Navy, transportation of troops, arms, munitions of war, the mails, and for other governmental and public uses. The 1914 Act also granted rights of way through federal lands for that railroad and authorized the federal government to establish rules and regulations for control and operation of the railroad. Now, the Alaska Railroad right-of-way was then designated and construction was completed in 1923. And for the next 60 years, the federal government owned and operated the Alaska Railroad, using it as both a railroad and a utility corridor. When Congress began discussing the concept of transferring the railroad to another entity in the early 1980s, congressional committees determined that most of the Alaska Railroad land, including its right-of-way, was held in fee simple title by the United States. And the original intent of Congress was that ARTA, and this is a quote from one of the Senate committees that looked into it, quote, would convey to the state a fee interest in the 200-foot strip comprising the railroad track right-of-way, amounting to roughly 12,000 acres. This fee estate is recognized by the committee to be the current interest of the Alaska Railroad derived from common practice and authorized under Section 1 of the March 12, 1914 Alaska Railroad Act. And the committee went on to explain that conveying the right-of-way in fee was required, quote, so that the state can continue to operate the railroad, unquote. Now, Congress also recognized in this process of looking at the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act that some Alaska Railroad lands could be subject to third-party claims. So it included in ARTA a process for determining such claims, but while still providing the state with exclusive control of the right-of-way. Senator Ted Stevens confirmed this on the floor of Congress just a few weeks before ARTA passed Congress. Here's a quote from Senator Stevens. The concept of an exclusive use easement also is introduced in the substitute. This defined interest represents the minimal interest of the state, the minimal interest the state is to receive in the Alaska Railroad right-of-way following completion of the expedited adjudication process. And Senator Stevens went on to describe the purpose of this exclusive use easement that was being proposed in ARTA. Quote, essentially, the exclusive use easement is defined to ensure that the state-owned railroad will receive exclusive and complete control over land traversed by the right-of-way, unquote. Now, ARTA's plain language, so now ARTA, this is in the discussions on the floor of the Senate before ARTA was passed. So now we move forward and look at what ARTA actually says. And ARTA's plain language confirms that the state-owned railroad was to receive exclusive control of the entire right-of-way. ARTA states, quote, Congress finds that exclusive control over the right-of-way by the Alaska Railroad has been and continues to be necessary to afford sufficient protection for safe and economic operation of the railroad. And this exclusive control provision specifically applies to any areas of the right-of-way that left federal ownership prior to the enactment date of ARTA. So this is getting right to what we're talking about here with the homestead patents. This is a quote, where lands within the right-of-way or any interest in such lands have been conveyed from federal ownership prior to January 14, 1983, or is subject to a claim of valid existing rights by a party other than a village corporation, the conveyance to the state of the federal interest in such properties pursuant to Section 1203B1B or 2 of this title, that's ARTA, shall grant not less than an exclusive use easement in such properties. So consistent with that language from ARTA, the transfers, the conveyances were made of Alaska Railroad land to the state-owned, newly formed Alaska Railroad Corporation. And consistent with the language that I've just recounted here, the interim conveyances that were issued in January 1985, which conveyed the right-of-way to the state-owned railroad, and also the final patents that followed later, they all expressly conveyed an exclusive use easement as that was defined in the Railroad Transfer Act. Now finally, third point I wanted to talk about now, although I'm sure there'll be lots of questions and there have been other issues raised by Representative Kopp and others, the Alaska Railroad right-of-way would be held exclusively by the railroad even if ARTA had not guaranteed this minimal interest of an exclusive use easement as is defined in that statute. And that's true because courts have consistently held for well over 100 years that railroads have exclusive rights to their right-of-way. And in the memo that we've supplied, from pages 9 through 11, we talk about some of those authorities, both court cases, legal treatises, commentators, things like that. And I don't have time to go through all of them, but I would just quote from a couple of the cases that kind of explain what the courts have done with these railroad right-of-way easements. And these are specifically cases talking about easements. The first one I wanted to mention is Midland Valley Railroad versus Sutter. And this is a 1928 case. And we have cases here starting in the early 1900s going all the way up to through till 2014. And just to quote some of the language out of that case, it says, the decisions of the national courts and of a majority of the state jurisdictions, however, are to the effect that the railroad company is entitled to the exclusive use and possession of its right-of-way, and that the owner of the Servian estate has no right to occupy the surface of the land conveyed for right-of-way in any mode or for any purpose without the railroad company's consent. And then it goes on, the court went on to talk about the reasons for that rule.
says the basic reason for the majority rule is that the exclusive possession is necessary to enable the railroad company to safely conduct its business and meet the duty of exercising that high degree of care which the general law and administrative rules enjoin upon it, meaning the railroad. And it went on to say, these duties require it to have the exclusive possession of its right-of-way. And, you know, even though some of these cases are old, there are we have cases here up through until recently, and we've heard the proponents of the joint resolution talk a lot about the 1875 Act, and there's a 2014 case that talks about this question of whether the right-of-way was exclusive under the 1875 Act. This is a California Court of Appeals decision from 2014, and it said, the court said, quote, as to rights-of-way granted by Congress in 1875 and beyond, the railroad has exclusive rights to the surface and, in addition, broad and extensive rights of sublateral and subjacent support to prohibit interference with railroad operations and maintenance.
Okay, thank you. That's your 10 minutes. I'll open it up for questions for Mr. Barron, Representative Kopp.
Thank you. Mr. Barron, so you said that the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act's plain language requires transfer of the federal interest in the right-of-way. Where in the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act does it say that something the federal government does not own must be transferred?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, I don't think there is anything. I'm sorry. This is Andy Barron, Chief Counsel, Alaska Railroad. I don't think there is language to that effect in the Transfer Act, but there is language in the Transfer Act that says that the federal government must transfer at least an exclusive use easement as defined in the Rail Transfer Act. I mean, that's clear. That interest must be conveyed. It doesn't talk about interests being conveyed that are not owned. And clearly, from the legislative history, Congress appeared to believe that the Federal Railroad had these exclusive rights to transfer. And so, you know, that is how the real point is that Congress found that exclusive control was necessary to run a safe and economic railroad. Congress determined that minimum interest must be transferred, and then those interests were transferred. And so it doesn't say that interests that aren't owned have to be transferred. It's clear that from the legislative history that the statute was premised on the fact that the Federal Railroad actually did own those rights. Okay. And the only other thing I would say is a couple things. One is the state, the folks at the state who were negotiating for the transfer of the railroad, they were very clear that exclusive rights to the right-of-way were necessary for them to take the step of purchasing a railroad which had dated infrastructure, had been losing money under the management of the federal government, and that it believed, and clearly Congress found, that the exclusive control of the right-of-way was necessary to have this going concern railroad. And so all of those issues come together to where you not only have the direction to convey an exclusive use easement to the state-owned railroad, but also the federal government saying if any party brings an action challenging the railroad's title to its property, the federal government will step in and defend that title. So it's a very unusual provision, but it shows how important that issue was.
Sure.
Representative Kopp.
So, Mr. Barron's, would you say you're confident that the federal government possessed an interest strong enough to pass an exclusive use easement to the state in the entire right-of-way? Are you confident of that?
This is Andy Barron from the Alaska Railroad through the chair, Representative Kopp. We believe we have a very strong argument to that effect. We don't question the sincerity of those folks who are arguing on the other side. But based on, one, the 1914 Act, which we disagree with, we disagree that it provided the same title that the 1875 Act did. And the reason that, one reason that it's much different is the 1875 Act, as you correctly pointed out, was an act which basically went from granting what's almost basically fee interest to an act which granted a railroad easement. And in the case of the 1914 Act that created the Alaska Railroad, you had federal government directing not a grant to private railroad companies, and that was the real problem before 1875, was private railroad companies, as you said, blocking off, you know, tying up big swaths of land and blocking people from using it. In this case, in the Alaska Railroad case, the Alaska Railroad Act of 1914 directed the president to create up to 1,000 miles long Alaska Railroad. And it even brought in, it's kind of interesting, it directed them to bring in resources from the Panama Canal Project to help get the Alaska Railroad built. And it did so as a way of opening up and developing the state of Alaska. And this was going to be a federally owned, federally operated railroad. And so this wasn't a grant of federal land to a private company. This was the federal government designating land to be used for a railroad. That's a much different... That's part of the basis. The next part of the basis of being comfortable with it is these cases which show that railroad rights of way, even where they are easements, even where it's an 1875 Act easement, it does provide exclusive rights to the railroad. And that's another basis. There's no question that the federal government, the Federal Alaska Railroad, ran a railroad for 60 years and that it moved trains and that there were utility uses made of the right of way. And we believe that that's an additional, albeit we think it's more of a backup argument, but it's an additional argument that shows that there were exclusive rights in the right of way that could be conveyed.
And okay. Representative, got one more follow-up, and Mr. Behrens, I want to note, lawyers are good at talking a long time, but they're also good at following time limits, and I'm going to put some time limits on your next answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So House Joint Resolution 38 just says that the federal government cannot transfer an interest to the state it does not own. So if you are confident that that did not happen, why would you be opposing House Joint Resolution 38?
I'll give you about 2 minutes to answer that one. You don't have to take it all, though.
Andy Behrens, Alaska Railroad Corporation Chief Counsel, through the Chair, Representative Kopp. We do feel comfortable with our position, and that's the position that we depend on every day to operate the railroad. We do believe that I think there have been examples from my testimony where we disagree with some of the premises of House Joint Resolution 38. And the other piece of it is, it appears to us that House Joint Resolution 38 is seeking to ask Congress to take some sort of action, but it doesn't. There's no specification as to what that action would be. We really strongly believe that we're right on the law. I know that the constituents who are behind are supporting this think they're right on the law, and we think that the courts are the right place because these are complex legal issues.
Thank you, Representative Kopp.
I think I'm done messing.
You are done. Representative Reinbold.
Okay, so this is going to show a little bit of my unawareness of how often you guys run through different areas and all that, but I guess to me, if you run across 500 miles of property, let's say 5 minutes of time in a 24-hour period, and I don't know if you run the schedule every day for 365 days or whatever, but it just seems like 5 minutes is not a huge amount of time to lock up the whole area, you know, for exclusive rights forever, you know, just just for a quick pass-by. So I guess where I'm going with this is there's a safety and profitability. Those are the two reasons you keep giving over and over again for why you're opposing this resolution. So, one, I want to ask the state funding in total since 1985, including, I believe you said, 12,000 acres and 500 miles. I think we passed a $80 million pass-through in fiscal year 2015 to you guys, but what's the total amount of public funds that you have used for the corporation, the Alaska Railroad Corporation? Do you have any idea or even a ballpark figure since 1985? Or
Mr. Barron, or, well, Mr. O'Leary?
Through the chair, Representative Reinhold, Bill O'Leary with the Alaska Railroad. We do not, as a matter of course, request state funds for the Alaska Railroad. In sense transfer, I'm aware that that there was, I believe, in the 90s, about a $10 million appropriation related to purchase of rail cars for, I think, the Wishbone Hill project, which didn't quite materialize. I believe there has also been somewhere perhaps $80 million related to the bridge over the Tanana River as part of the Northern Rail Extension. And I believe there was also some money possibly in the right around $34 million, I believe, related to the unfunded federal mandate of positive train control. So it is over. Were very large projects that are not necessarily something matter of daily business for the Alaska Railroad. Has state money been requested or received?
Okay, so through the chair, it sounds like you got the whole railroad in addition to a couple $10 million and then a $34 million back in, I think it was fiscal year 2015, which I always thought you should have gone to the federal government for a federal mandate. It always ticked me off that you guys came to us, you know, and made us use state funds when I knew we were facing a crisis. But anyway, how profitable are you as a corporation, and does any money ever come back to the general fund?
More like our financials look like private enterprise, or more like private enterprise. So we measure actually net income, and our net income probably on average is somewhere over the past 10 years or so in the 12 to $14 million range would be my guess at this particular point. Capital intensive. We believe we need to be putting upwards of $40 million per year into our existing infrastructure to basically just, this is without any kind of expansion or necessarily improvement, but just to, as I call it, kind of keep the wheels on the wagon on this. To answer your question with regard to, if the question was, do we pay a dividend or any money coming back to the general fund, we do not.
Okay, and
the
final question, who do you see as oversight to the Alaska Railroad? Do you see the legislature as oversight? Just want to know, who do you think is your oversight, Railroad Corp?
Overseers, if that's the right word at this point, as well as the all of the regulatory agencies that any railroad would have, the Federal Railroad Administration. There's oversight by the Federal Transit Administration. We have a 7-member board of directors that is appointed by the governor with specific statutory requirements for those board members. There are requirements for us to report to the legislature. There are requirements for us to come to the legislature for specific activities. We certainly, you know, 2 members of our board are commissioners of the governor's cabinet. So we serve many masters.
So just Representative Reinbold, that was your third question. Representative Eastman.
Just to see if we were oversight. He didn't answer.
Through the chair, Mr. O'Leary, I was wondering, are you aware of any other areas of U.S. property law where you'd have a property owner who is paying taxes on their property, but someone else has an exclusive use to a portion of that property, and The homeowner is, or the property owner is the one paying taxes, but the person with the exclusive use is not. I'm just, how common is that of an occurrence?
And I'll actually, you guys to decide who's better to answer that question. You can decide amongst yourselves.
Please.
Just tell us who won.
Andy Barron, Chief Counsel, Alaska Railroad, through the chair to Representative Eastman. First, I do think I didn't participate in the answer on the taxation issue. I was not aware of the issue about Flying Crown, but I have looked at the tax lot situation in most of the Potter Hill area in South Anchorage, and consistent with the platting of those subdivisions, which show the lots only going up to but not across the boundary of the right-of-way, I'm only aware of one situation where someone is being taxed, a homeowner is being taxed on a lot in that area. All the rest of the of that whole Potter Hill, South Anchorage area, and I think this is fairly standard for the railroad, although I haven't looked at it, so I don't want to say that for sure. The residents are not paying taxes on the right-of-way. There was one taxpayer who showed us that she was being taxed on the right-of-way. We said we couldn't do anything directly for her, but we'd be happy to write a letter on her behalf to the municipality saying that we didn't believe she should be taxed on it because it was our property, and she declined our assistance with that. But I'm not aware of any other situations like you ask about, but we don't think that's the situation, at least not as to the vast majority of our right-of-way. We believe that folks who live along the right-of-way are not paying property tax on that. And if there are examples of that, you know, we could look at that. Not that we can do anything about the taxation, but we'd be happy to write a letter on behalf of any taxpayer who's paying property tax on part of our right of way.
Representative Eastman, follow up.
Yeah. So just to confirm. So other than these, however many cases involving the Alaska Railroad, you're not aware of any other examples in U.S. property law where this situation is happening?
The answer through the Andy Barron, Alaska Railroad Chief Counsel, through the Chair, Representative Eastman, I was answering based on the question of whether people were paying taxes on right-of-way property that was subject to an exclusive use easement, and I don't know outside of Alaska, I don't know what is typically done. So I guess the answer is yes. I'm not aware of anything in other jurisdictions, but I haven't looked into it.
Thank you.
Further follow-up?
Not at this time.
I don't see anyone else with questions. I would like to get the public testimony today. So thank you very much. We're in public and invited testimony. We will go to public testimony. We'll start with the folks that are here in Juneau. Errol Champion, if you're still here, Mr. Champion. And folks here for public testimony, you guys get 2 minutes. If you could state your name for the record, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Errol Champion, and I'm here as chair of the Legislative Issues Committee for the Alaska Association of Realtors. And my first statement is I believe in brevity. I've already submitted a letter to you stating support for this resolution. The realtors think that there's a lot of benefits that come if it is enacted and put into place. And I simply will end at that and answer any questions you might have.
I don't think we have any questions. Thank you very much for coming today. Next here in the room, we've got Kate Blair.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Kate Blair, and I'm the Government and Public Affairs Manager for Endeavor, formerly known as the Tesoro Corporation. Endeavor is an integrated refining, logistics, and marketing company with assets all across the United States. We operate 10 refineries, including our first here in Nikiski, and also own a series of pipelines, tank farms, marine, rail, and a network of fuel stations. This is our 49th year operating in the 49th state, refining Alaska's crude into transportation fuels and home heating fuels for Alaskans. In 2016, Andeavor purchased assets in Anchorage and Fairbanks from Flint Hills Resources, and a main driver for that investment was the rail facilities at either end. The railroad allows us to move our products into the interior in a safe, reliable, and economic manner. Our concern with the resolution is the impact that it could potentially have on the railroad's commercial operations and the ability to run the train at higher speeds. As our operator, the Alaska Railroad has asserted that the unrestricted use of the right-of-way by adjoining residents and the public would require the lower train speeds of 20 miles an hour or 16 miles an hour in some areas. So that slowdown would mean a significant change to the current travel time to Fairbanks and would change the schedule and economics of deliveries into the interior. So it is not our place to weigh in on the property or the land ownership of the right-of-way. However, if there are changes made to the way that the railroad has to operate, it is important to recognize that those changes would in turn affect our fuel delivery and make transportation into the interior more expensive. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
I see that Representative Eastman has a question, and just because we've got actually quite a number of people today, I'm going to limit folks to one question per member if you have questions. Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Ms. Blair. I appreciate the concern that you stated. So the public's certainly aware of the last time we had a federal government shutdown under the Obama administration and what happened to national parks and people not being able to see Mount Rushmore and those kinds of things. And certainly that was understood to be politically motivated, and there was no legal requirement that people weren't allowed to look at Mount Rushmore. Just there was a policy, and that was the response. Can you distinguish this slowing down from that kind of situation? What would be legally requiring the operator to travel at those slower speeds so that I can explain to my constituents that it's not politically motivated?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, we are not the operator of the Alaska Railroad. We work with the Alaska Railroad, and they are our operator. So if they tell us that because of safety through the right-of-way, safety is a core value of Andeavor's. It is not a priority. It is a core value. It will never change. It is our number one core value. If they tell us that as the operator, they need to go slower speeds for safety, we must trust that that is what they need to do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, any other questions for Ms. Blair? Don't see any. Next in the room is Barbara Huff-Tuckness. Thank you very much for coming today.
Good afternoon. I believe it's still afternoon. Mr.
Chairman. Not evening. The sun is out.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Tuckness. I am the Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959, and in recognition of the time constraints, my comments will be brief. We're here today in opposition to HJR 38. While the legal arguments we believe should be left with the attorneys, and I am not one for the record, there should be a concern regarding the safety of not only the members that we represent that work for the railroad, but also for the public. This resolution, as written, threatens and undermines protections offered by the exclusive right-of-way. This could create uncertainty as well as potential financial liability for the railroad. If the railroad is not able to have full control of its access to the right-of-way or to that particular buffer. The buffer, from at least what we understand, again, we represent some of the workers, not all of the workers at the railroad. The buffer is very important to the successful operation of the trains, and especially at higher speeds when transporting not only passengers but also freight throughout the state as well. To reduce the effectiveness of the trains by reducing speed would have a huge negative impact on the railroad's ability to meet delivery times, forcing many to look at other means of transportation. And I guess as a Teamster, maybe we throw out, and the railroad's probably not going to appreciate this, we put more of the freight on trucks out there. In honesty, we don't have a lot of roads in our state, and there's always been that working relationship between the truckers and the railroad on what how our different goods and services are actually transported around the state. So I don't see that as necessarily an option, but it would be.
Ms. Huff-Tuckness, you're about your two-minute mark, so if you could conclude that.
And wrap up. Additionally, with the elimination of the exclusive control of right-of-way reduces revenues for the railroad and also creates an unsafe situation. In summary, we believe
that's
the
points. You've got your point well taken. Your time's up. Representative Eastman has one question.
Thank you, ma'am. Appreciate the concern. And I'm wondering, is your concern based on your own legal analysis, or are you taking just the perspective of the railroad as far as the requirement for reduced speeds and so forth?
Well, actually, it's not a legal perspective, and I did state I'm not an attorney, just for the record. It's been discussions that we've had with some of our members that actually work on the railroad. Again, the speeds, and I think the comment that was made earlier by Representative Reinbold, if it's only one or two areas. What I understand, this would be through all of the miles of the track itself, and even currently, I did take a train ride myself personally this summer. It took us 8 hours to get from Anchorage to Denali, and there were, even without the passage of this resolution, there were areas where the train did slow down. Now, I don't know the answer as to why, other than we were viewing some wildlife, but to have that train further slowed down would have, I mean, on a personal side, impacted even our ability to connect with some of the tourist opportunities as we stopped along the way.
Thank you very much.
Representative Reinbold, one question.
Well, I probably should have asked this question previously, but I want to know how many times a day this happens. But it just seems to me that slowing the train down a little bit, maybe 20 miles an hour, I think, what they said would actually increase safety. It may slow down delivery times a little bit, but I don't see it as, you know, a huge, if it's, you know, 5 minutes late or something like that, as a huge crisis to not be able to work with landowners and be a good neighbor. So trying to figure out how slowing a train down could impact safety is really baffling me.
Well, actually, slowing down the train because you don't have the control in those right-of-ways under this particular, if they're, I guess, taking this to the further degree, the way our council has read this resolution, it would ask our congressional delegation to actually reinterpret the law. And if the law were to be reinterpreted in the end, both sides are going to end up, if one side or the other gets a decision they don't like, they're going to end up ultimately in court anyway. But the safety part of that would be a requirement and a concern. If I was the owner of the railroad, if I don't have any control over those areas of right-of-way any longer, then I would want to make sure that we don't have kids running out in the middle of the track or any cars going through if there aren't any crossings or any ultimately any protection for that right-of-way area. So I think that's at least from my perspective, and there may be other testifiers that could get into more specifics that actually work for the railroad. As I understand, there may be some folks that actually are going to be testifying. But as I understand, the slowdown would be because they don't have, theoretically, the control of the right-of-way anymore. So they would want to do that or need to do that for protection.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Barb. Can you imagine why a property owner would opt for conduct that would cause a spill on their property or a disaster on their property that would get them hurt or killed? I can't.
I'm not really sure how to answer that. I know that there have been individuals killed even in the municipality of Anchorage, where they now have fences in that downtown area, there was a child that was killed. And the railroad, and I don't know all the particulars of the case, but those, unfortunately, those kind of situations do happen if...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm done.
I think that's a point well taken. Okay. We're going to go. That's all the people, I think. Anybody else in the room that I don't have on my list that wants to testify? If you haven't testified, put your hand up or come forward. All right. That brings us. We'll go to the folks on the phone. We'll start with Charles Dillard, who I believe is in the Anchorage LIO. Mr. Dillard, please state any affiliation you may have, and you can proceed with your public testimony. Mr. Dillard, are you there?
Yes.
Ah, okay, go ahead.
Thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Charles Dillard. I'm a 50-year employee of the Alaska Railroad, and I've been working on rail cars almost my entire life. I started out as an apprentice carman, moved up to freight carman, became a carman inspector, then a carman leader, and I've been a carman write-up inspector since 2007. I'm here today representing the 40 members of the Brotherhood of Railway Carmen Division of the Transportation Communications International Union at the Alaska Railroad, of which I am a member. On behalf of the members of TCU, I'm here to ask you to oppose House Joint Resolution 38. This is an incredibly important issue for all of us that work at the Alaska Railroad. For the 50 years that I have been at this job, safety has been our highest priority. Making safety a priority is what allowed me to make it home every night. This resolution greatly reduces our ability to operate a safe railroad. This resolution asks Congress to move the Alaska Railroad exclusive control of the right-of-way, which I can tell you by being here for 50 years, this is something that the railroad has always had. Doing this poses a safety risk to all of the Alaska Railway employees that work on the tracks because we would not be able to say what happens in the right-of-way. It also poses a threat to our jobs. The railroad would have to reduce speed significantly in areas that it does not have the exclusive control of. This could make it nearly impossible to move passengers and freight in a timely manner and could cause us to lose business.
Mr. Dillard.
I would encourage you to vote no on House Joint Resolution 38. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next in the queue, we have James Abitz. I apologize if I mispronounced. He's also calling, and I think from the Anchorage LIO. Mr. Abitz, please state any affiliation you may have as well.
Hey, thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Abitz, and I represent the 40 members of the Brotherhood of Railway Carmen Division Transportation Communications International Union. I am here today on behalf of the members of PCU to ask you to oppose House Joint Resolution 38. This is an incredibly important issue for all of us that work at the Alaska Railroad. This resolution asks Congress to remove the Alaska Railroad's exclusive control of the right-of-way, which it has always had. Doing this poses a safety risk to all of the Alaska Railroad employees that work on the tracks because we wouldn't be able to control the right-of-way. It also poses a threat to our jobs. The railroad would have to reduce speed significantly where it doesn't have exclusive control. This could make it nearly impossible to move passengers and freight in a timely manner and could cause us to lose significant business. This could cause many of my members to lose their jobs. Finally, I would like the committee to recognize that there is a disagreement over who owns the land, that this is the sort of issues people are supposed to go to court over to determine legally who's right and who's wrong.
It's not something that should be done politically by going back, changing law to suit what just some people want. I appreciate your time and encourage you to vote no on House Point Resolution 38. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next in the queue, I've got Vern Gillis. Mr. Gillis, if you could state your name and identify any affiliation you may have. He's also calling from the Anchorage LIO.
Thank you, the committee. My name is Vern Gillis. I'm a conductor with the Alaska Railroad. I also represent the Alaska Transportation Union. I've worked in the transportation industry for 28 years. I'm a conductor with the Alaska Railroad. It is my responsibility to move passengers and freight safely and efficiently. I represent 150 members who strongly oppose House Joint Resolution 38. Safety of my passengers is a huge concern. Opening up the right-of-way will only increase the dangers to both the public and the railroad. As a trainman, one of the worst feelings I have endured is coming around the curve and looking into the eyes of people of a trespasser who has no idea whether they should move to the left or to the right to escape the train. In most cases, people freeze and are not able to move. As adults, we teach to the best of our abilities. As a parent, we teach with instinct. One of the most important things we teach our children is not to play in the road. Please do not play in the road in which I am trying to work. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate the Trust Buck Friday.
Thank you very
My name is Lee Davis. I'm a conductor and engineer with the Alaska Railroad. I'm also an officer with the Smart Transportation Union. I have 150 Alaska Railroad members and 25 members that work for the bike pass and Yukon route. I've been an engineer for 25 years. I've seen the darker side of train and civilian, or as the railroad classifies and disappears, their interactions. My first year with the railroad, I was working at yard job when we put a jacket that was laying on the ground. When we stopped, there was a person carrying the jacket laying so close to the rail that we ran over and crushed it with the jacket. I also, my most frightening experience was around Birdwood. I was working as an engineer on a passenger train. Came around the curve. A man was walking with his two young daughters, one probably five and one younger. When he heard the whistle, he stepped off the tracks to one side, his daughter stepped to the other side. In the few seconds between when we started blowing the horn and we got to the people, the daughter, older daughter, made two steps toward the tracks to try to cross in front to get back to her dad as he's telling her to stay. On March 13th of this year, 23-year-old Skylar Luke of New Haven, Alaska, was struck and killed by an Alaska Railroad train between C Street and Arctic Boulevard. The engineer blew the horn, rang the bell to apply the brakes. I was that engineer. Injuries and fatalities happen often, enough on railroads nationwide that a program for employees volunteer for training to assist crew members that are involved in serious accidents. We have that peer support to prepare the Alaska Road. Hope a similar group isn't needed for the people that live along the right-of-way as the train and trespasser interactions increase if the railroad loses control of this area. Every time a train makes an emergency stop, there's a risk that the train will break apart and cause a derailment. This is not discussed today or the ones that involve...
Mr. Davis, you're...
There are many more examples of people on the tracks who were killed or injured. Certainly more dangerous place than it appears. I encourage belief, control of the right-of-way in the hands of the Alaska Railroad to provide a safe environment for me, my co-workers, and the citizens who live along the tracks. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next is Tom Meacham, also calling from the Anchorage LIO. Mr. Meacham, and please state any affiliation you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Meacham. I'm an attorney in Anchorage. I don't currently represent anybody involved in the HAR 38 issue, but I am familiar with the statute that transferred the railroad from the federal government to the state. I think Mr. Barron has perhaps conveniently ignored the fact that the only two areas of substantive operative law in the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act in which exclusive use easements are imposed are the federal lands in Denali National Park and unresolved Native land claims. there is the provision of ARTA that deals with exclusive use over parcels of land that are not in Denali National Park is limited to the lands that were presently subject to unresolved native claims. I think Representative Kopp has very accurately outlined the situation we have here and why HR 38 is necessary. I would point out that 70 years of operation of the Federal Alaska Railroad without asserting an explicit exclusive use easement was very successful. And in fact, I think the portion of the exclusive use easement that riles most people is the fact that the railroad believes it can, under that easement, can fence the land and prevent any other use, even uses compatible with railroad operations. One other point that I think really needs to be emphasized is that there's a provision of ARTA that says that any unresolved claims regarding the rights of the railroad and other property owners or claimants are to be resolved by the Secretary of the Interior under a specific provision of ARTA. And I know Representative Kopp has asked the railroad for a list of all of those conflicting claims that were resolved under this provision. He hasn't yet received it, but I venture to say that none of the 200 private homesteader-type landowners or more along the railroad were involved in any such adjudications because they did not take place. Thank you. I don't have any further testimony.
Thank you very much. Next, I think that's everyone in the Anchorage LIO. Next, we have a John Pletcher who's phoning in, I believe, from Anchorage. Mr. Pletcher, please state your name and any affiliation you may have.
My name is John Pletcher. I'm a resident of Anchorage. I live next to Ocean View Park. And I'm a member of the our Community Council Railroad Committee. I'd like to call your attention to my website, www.railroadedalaska.com, if you'd like to read more than you would like to read about the background of all of this. There's a lot of reading material there. You know, one of the things that was mentioned here is trespassers. Trespassers do not get on the tracks over private property. They don't. The way that they get on the track is on road crossings, which is a public area, somewhat on parks. A couple of years ago, an Asian lady got out of her car down in the Potter area, walked up onto the railroad tracks and was taking a picture, and she got run over by this thing. And all of this has nothing to do at all with House Joint Resolution 38. Nothing. Because House Joint Resolution 38 only goes to the issue of how in the dickens did the federal government manage to convey property rights that they didn't own. The property rights that were owned by the federal government across homestead land is the reservation for railroad, telegraph, and telephone that's found in every federal land patent along the tracks. I took the liberty of going back and researching this thoroughly, and I found that that railroad, telegraph, and telephone easement was what Jay Hammond called the standard easement in Alaska for railroads, and actually it's a national standard that was created under the General Railroad Act of 1875. And in the letter of March 82 to Congress, when the Fencer Act was pending, he said that he hoped that it would be the easement even for rail extensions, like going into Canada. And so there's no way that Jay Hammond would have gone along with changing it. I took the liberty also of interviewing a fellow named Don Young, who's our congressman.
Mr. Pletcher, you're a little past your 2 minutes.
He confirms that there was no intention to change this vested property rights and homestead patents.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Please state any affiliation you may have and be sure to tell us your name.
Good afternoon, members of the Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Stephen McAlpine. I'm with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. However, I'm not appearing in my official capacity. I'm appearing as a private individual. I was Lieutenant Governor at the time that the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act had been finalized, and we were securing the actual transfer. And I can assure the members of this committee, the members of the legislature and Alaska public, that an overriding concern, one of the most important concerns that we had, was that the Alaska Railroad would have an exclusive easement. When you stop and think about it, Alaska is one of the few states that has an easement that runs clear across this state from Prudhoe Bay to Fairbanks, on to Valdez with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and down to Seward with the Alaska Railroad. This measure is really a license to trespass, and one could say it almost rises to the level of advocating larceny. The courts are, in fact, where these people should go if they believe that the railroad transfer was contrary to law. In every other circumstance, that's where we settle certain legal disputes. What is really being attempted here is to have the Alaska legislature adopt a resolution in support of their position so that they can take it back to Congress and parade it before the federal body, saying that they have the support of the state of Alaska to go back and amend the Transfer Act. I'd like to thank the members of the committee and Mr. Chairman for my opportunity to be here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next in the queue is Fred Rosenberg, also calling from Anchorage.
Fred Rosenberg is here. I'm the thank you for an opportunity to be heard. I am the owner of Diamond Capital Company, LLC, that owns a property on Diamond Boulevard in Anchorage where the Red Robin is currently located. It's clear that, I believe it's clear, that everybody wants safety. But the Alaska Railroad says it needs their exclusive right-of-way, and that's what it needs to be safe. But the reality is today, this isn't a question of their need. It's really a question of property ownership and property rights. And I believe really what's before us today is pretty simple. Property owners, including myself, have a fee simple ownership dating back to the lineage and the real estate title from a patent. The federal government and the state government apparently tried to transfer certain rights or did it unclearly that they didn't have the right to transfer. That's like owning your own home or other property and having someone else transfer rights to your property without you knowing about it or without proper authority. Simply put, the conveyances that we're discussing infringe on private property rights. They're not valid. And the titles of these properties in question, should these improper claims by the railroad even be considered, those claims should be expunged so as to not impair the property rights of private property owners, and the properties should not be affected. There's constant talk about other, the railroad talks about other issues with other railroads around in the lower 48, but I think that you'll find that the properties up here that had fee simple ownership because of how it came about are not the same as the properties in the lower 48. We do have fee simple ownership dating back to an original federal patent, and nobody has the right to abridge that right as a property owner. Thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate being heard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rosenberg. Next in the queue is Hugh Ashlock, calling from Anchorage. Be sure to state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the chair, my name is Hugh Ashlock, owner of Diamond Center Mall in Anchorage, Alaska. On behalf of our 12 million annual customers and my family, who've been original owners for over 40 years, we are very concerned about the clouds that this creates on our title. My father purchased the property from Texas, the original homesteader, and via the Homesteader Act, I have rights that are frankly being usurped here. We're probably worth in excess of $100 million. We've just put $40 million more into the shopping center. So we have a large economic concern here, and the cloud and the use of it are very concerning to us economically. So thank you very much for your time and effort.
Thank you very much. Anchorage, please state your name and any affiliation. Mr. Brown? Going. Mr. Brown, last chance. Next in the queue is Jody Taylor, also calling from Anchorage. Ms. Taylor.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. This is Jody Taylor, and I represent the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We have 85 acres of property up in Willow, Alaska, and our church has about 34,000 members in Alaska, and we have several youth camps, family camps, young adult camps that go and use that property. The railroad runs through part of that property, and in early 2000, the railroad came and mandated that we put a 6-foot high fence up for 500 feet on either side of the property. or excuse me, either side of the railroad. And a part of that also was that we would get one mandate on either side of the property to let people come in and out, and then one vehicle gate. And then in 2005, they came back and wanted us to rip down that fence, put in another fence. And this time they wanted it, I'm sorry, the first time they wanted it 50 feet off center of the track. The second time it was 100 feet off center of the track. And that time again, it was both times at our expense in 2005 when we did that. And then we put a padlock on the vehicle gate. And the railroad came and cut the padlock off of our vehicle gate, put their own padlock on. So we have no access to the lakefront portion of the property that we have. And as you can imagine, with youth, young adults, and families there, if anything was to come up at the lakefront, we don't have any access to first responders or otherwise to get through to get over to the lakefront part of our property. We support the railroad's right to have safety, but we also think that this resolution provides a common sense solution to letting property owners manage their property. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I've got Robert Timmons calling from Eagle River. Mr. Timmons, please state any affiliation.
Paul?
Go ahead.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I would like to second everything that the previous caller, Jody Taylor, had to say about HJR 38. I'm in full support of HJR 38 and its resolution. I am also a member of said church and have actually been to the camp and seen the injustice that HJR 38 will resolve. And I would just highly encourage you to understand the veracity of what is of the testimony that has just occurred and second it. And thank you very much for my call.
Thank you very much. I don't see anyone else in the room that has arrived that would like, that I think wants to testify, and Mr. Timmons was the last person I show on my list of folks online that would like to testify. So with that, I'm going to close the public testimony on House Joint Resolution 38. Representative Ledoux, I know you wanted a chance for brief committee comments. I'll give all, because I've got a 3:15 elsewhere. I'll give everyone about a minute and a half if you want to make comments, but obviously not required. This is not the last hearing of this bill.
So, I mean, I'm looking at page 3, lines 28 through 31, and then page 4, line 1. And it seems like the whole gist of this resolution is to encourage Congress to recognize, quote, validly held private property rights that were not conveyed under the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act of 1982. But whether or not there were validly held private property rights that were not conveyed under the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act of 1982 doesn't actually seem like something that Congress can do. I mean, Congress is not a court that makes decisions about what is validly held and what was not conveyed. And I've listened to, even though I actually am a lawyer, I've listened to, but I wasn't a property lawyer, what sounded like to me a bunch of legal gobbledygook about right-of-ways. And I actually doubt, other than, you know, the attorneys listening who are property lawyers, that anybody actually knows whether the railroad's right or whether Representative Kopp is right. And, you know, I'm not going to try to hold this bill, you know, from going to committee, from out of committee or anything, but I guess I'm just not really sure what this does, because it seems like this thing needs to be decided in a court once and for all.
All right. Representative, thank you.
Oh, and one more thing.
Well, Representative, you're 37. Really, I've got to be at a committee 3:15, and we will hear this one more time. So, brief comment, Representative Reingold, because we're going to
I know the Timmons, and I know Craig and Jody Taylor, and they are outstanding individuals, outstanding. They have been outstanding neighbors, and to think and to see and to hear what the railroad is doing when they're trying to build fences, trying to be collaborative, and then these big bullies come and put a separate, cut the padlock off and put a padlock. That's the kind of stuff why I think that this resolution, I am leaning more in support of it than before, just because of the big bad government treatment of outstanding neighbors.
Thank you very much. this is all right, Representative.
My comment is Mr. Hugh Ashlock, who testified from the public. It was hard for me to make out his testimony, and if he's listening, I would appreciate his testimony in writing.
Thank you, Mr. Ashlock. If you're still listening, if you could submit your testimony in writing.
To Congress' attention is while the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act directed that the federal interest, whatever they owned, be transferred to the state, it was the Department of Interior, a large federal agency that inexplicably and undefensibly transferred more than what the federal government owned in these 2005 and 2006 land patents without any notice to affected landowners in those years. And that is where the misapplication of a federal agency became involved, and we need Congress to help resolve that. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much. So we're going to hold this bill consistent with the prior bill, 351. We'll be sending out an amendment, and we'll send that probably in the same email saying when those amendments are due. But we will hold it till next week. We will recess at this point. Our next meeting is scheduled for Monday, April 9th. We are recessing to the call of the chair. We may continue the meeting later today. I haven't made that decision yet. On Monday, we will hear Senate Bill 202, Native Corporation Liability for Contamination, sponsored by Senator Hoffman, and House Bill 336, Supportive Decision-Making Agreement, sponsored by Representative Millett. A reminder that if anyone is considering offering amendment to Senate Bill 202, please let my office know, and they must be submitted electronically by 4 p.m. today. We will stand in recess to the call of the chair. It is 3:11 p.m.
Sound check, testifier 1, 2, 3.
That one's good.
Sound check, 1, 2, 3.
That's good.
Check, mic, 1, 2, 3.
Good.
Check, mic, 1, 2, 3.
Good.
Chair, mic, 1, 2, 3.
That's good.
Mic check, 1, 2, 3. Check. Mic, 1, 2, 3. Well, that's pretty bright. Okay. Mic check, 1, 2, 3.
That sounds good.
That's the works.
Yeah, I'll weigh in on it.
These two sound mega loud, so I'll check them out.
They're fine in here.
They work?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome, Lord.
Yeah. Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 7:46 p.m. on Friday, April 6, 2018. Before we begin, I want to thank Lori, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Doug from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Kopp, Representative Reinbold, Representative Stutz, Representative Christ-Tompkins, and myself, Representative Clayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business this evening is House Bill 75, Gun Violence Protective Order, sponsored by Representative Tarr. The bill in the Judiciary Committee. At this time, I would like to start considering amendments to House Bill 75. I will put on record that Legislative Legal has permission to make any technical and conforming amendments today. The only amendments we'll be taking up today are amendments 1 through 7. The other amendments have not been ruled out of order. They will be considered in due course, but they're not going to be considered at the meeting tonight. And because the first six amendments are amendments that I've offered, I'm going to pass the gavel to my vice chair, Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Representative Clayman. Is there a motion to bring amendment number 1 before the committee?
I move amendment number 1.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
And Mr. Chairman? I have a point of order.
Representative Stutes? Yes, do you have a point of order?
Point of order, I want to know, there was a deadline, and these are supposed to be timely, and I want to know when this one was, 1 through 7 were submitted.
Representative Reinbold, I'll let you consult with Representative Clayman about when these amendments were submitted after the meeting.
That's fine.
Not after the meeting, it's a point of order. They're supposed to be timely. And he had a deadline.
Representative Clayman, Amendment Number 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Amendment Number 1 is a response to clarification that was brought by the court system. They wanted to make sure that the language of the amendment accurately reflected the intent, which was to have publication on court view only occur if there was what we call a contested order, meaning where the individual had a right to be heard. So on an ex parte, if there was an ex parte hearing, a gun violence protective order was issued, that would not be listed on court view. The only time that a court view record of this proceeding would occur would be when the individual had a chance to be heard and the court had made a ruling.
Thank you, Representative Clayman. Questions for the maker of Amendment Number 1?
I'm trying to get a feel for what's being deleted. What is being deleted as I look it up?
Mr. Chairman, I was thinking because this is court view, maybe we could just have Ms. Mead just come and just walk us through it.
Sure. Ms. Mead, would you be available to walk us through Amendment Number 1 and specifically the deletion of material in Amendment Number 1?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Version R of HB 75 has a sentence saying that the court system may not publish a court record of a protective order on a publicly available website, and it was my thinking that this was reflect the full intent of the committee, and I was seeking a little bit of clarity so that the court system does indeed do whatever the committee wanted. And so the Amendment Number 1 clarifies that what the court will do is, as Representative Clayman explained, you only if and when the long-term protective order is issued, so that if there's a petition for a short-term order, we would handle the case in the normal course, but nothing would go on court view because the proceeding is ex parte until and if a longer-term order was issued after the which occurs after the respondent, the subject of the order, has a chance to appear and get full due process. So Amendment Number 1 clarifies that that's what we would do. And I think that was the intent of the less clear wording in the original version of the bill.
Representative Eastman, do you have questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm curious, this 10-day language, is that how does that compare or contrast to other things that get put up on court view? Is that same or different?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, this is a little bit different. We typically review with very few exceptions, and the exceptions are what you see in the existing language in AS 2235030 above the newly inserted wording at the bottom of that page 1 of the amendment, and that is we do remove criminal cases, but again the default is always to put their public records 60 days after an acquittal or dismissal of all charges, if that's what occurs. Typically, protective orders are posted on court view, all, even the ex parte. I believe it was the intent of the sponsor and the committee that these could implicate some sensitive matters, and at the ex parte stage in particular, it may not be fully appropriate to publicize that this was occurring without full due process for the respondent. But after the full due process, we would put them on the website. Now, the 10 days really just gives us a chance to get the record together and do that. So that's where that came from.
And follow up. So if you were dealing with not this kind of protective order, but a domestic violence protective order, is the deadline of 10 days different or the same, or what is that?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we post everything about domestic violence protective orders the minute they are filed, and we post everything about them. This amendment reflects what I thought was the committee committee's intent to be more protective in these protective order proceedings because they do implicate a little bit more of a privacy interest, I guess, of the respondent. I don't mean to put into the sponsor's mouth, but I believe that's the thinking behind it. And therefore, we would delay and perhaps never post these proceedings unless and until that whole due process hearing had taken place.
Thank you.
Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Mead, thanks for being here this evening. What is the standard the court uses to make the finding on the six-month protective order?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, that is what I've been referring to as the longer-term order. Six-month order would be an appropriate wording to. That's covered in Section 7 of the bill, 1865.815, and that is the proceeding not ex parte, but on the other hand, that the respondent has notice and can be present, and the court has to find by clear and convincing evidence, and I'm reading from page 4 of the bill, line 13 on my version, I think we're in R, that the respondent is a dangerous individual, et cetera. So clear and convincing evidence.
Okay, so one more moment. So it's only after that determination has been made, the long-term order is issued, then with this amendment, it's at that point that it would be available for publication.
Through the chair to Representative Kopp, that's correct. Within 10 days after that, we would.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions for Ms. Mead?
I'll remove my objection.
Is there further objection to amendment number one?
I got in a little bit late, so can I ask some questions?
Yes, I heard a further objection from Representative Eastman, Representative Ledoux.
So, this still allows this to go up on court view. There's not a am I correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, if and when the longer term or the six-month order is granted by the court, then this would get posted on court view. Up until that time, this amendment would tell the court system not to post it, which is an exception to the normal rule of posting everything, generally.
Follow up.
Okay, so here's my problem here. I would think that it would be very appropriate to put on court view when there's a long-term protective order. If the protective order is because person A has said, hey, I'm going to blow up, you know, person B. But let's say person A is just really depressed. And so person A is thinking about killing themselves. And somehow or other, that just strikes me as wrong that you'd put that up on court view, period. And I don't know if there's a way of separating things.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, if I could respond. There's truly no way of separating them in the case. However, what might be interesting is that what gets posted on court view is not the content of the order and not the petition, which has all the allegations, nor any facts about the case. The court view in this, as in other cases, is not a screenshot of anything filed in the case, and it doesn't disclose anything. It's a docket sheet, which might be something that you're familiar with, so it would have the date of a petition for long-term gun violence protective order, date, order issued, but it would not disclose any of the facts that you're possibly concerned with.
You're right, but anybody who's curious enough to look on court view might find, ooh, somebody has a gun violence protective order, and that's going to perhaps lead them to the courthouse. Whereas if it wasn't up on court view, it wouldn't lead them to the courthouse.
And through the chair, Representative Ledoux, again, that it would be a policy call for this legislature to tell the court what to do. But again, what you may be interested in, we publish on Court View. Again, the default is everything is published unless there's a specific guidance not to. And, for example, divorce cases, which may and often do contain certain interesting or even salacious things. People can always come to the courthouse and look at records, and I guess the court system looks at that as our records are public. That's the kind of price of a democracy, and people are allowed to go and look and hold the court accountable by looking, and et cetera. But I recognize that there is another side to it.
No, I realize that. It's just that we are struggling right now with whether to allow the gun violence protective order in the first place. And I'd really want to make sure that somebody who is not thinking about doing violence to other people, I mean to other people, but simply might be thinking about doing violence to themselves, that wouldn't be published. How can we take care of that?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that would be extremely difficult and problematic for the court to take care of. We have no precedent for deciding what to post or not depending on the actual facts of the case. And the problem with that is there could be discrepancies depending on somebody's view of what's going on in the case. So we don't prefer something saying if it would be X, then post it, and if it wouldn't be, don't post it. In other words, the black and white line of full acquittal, take those cases off Court View, we can do. But if it takes discretion and thinking about actually what's going on in the case, that becomes a problem for the court system. And you could tell us not to post anything about them, even after the long term. We could do that, again, because that's a black and white line.
Representative Ledoux, further questions?
Or I guess we could also take, you know, suicides off of it, too, as a policy call.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you could make that policy call.
Representative Cobb.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm thinking of the numbers of suicides that I've worked, all very tragic, and how difficult it is for families to accept on the death certificate suicide, some for religious purposes, some because of just tremendous weight of guilt that they carry for, you know, not being able to be there to stop it, or maybe the last exchange they had with a loved one was less than pleasant. And suicide is really is just an awful thing. It's an awful scourge in Alaska. So I'm just considering the merits of this discussion. If the risk, as Representative Ledoux has pointed out, is strictly toward oneself, and so you are a loved one wanting to hopefully remove a temptation so they don't take their life and maybe buy more time to get them help, I'm wondering if that all comes down to the definition of dangerous individual and under what circumstance would a case be posted on Court View. And it could be that we could look at an amendment like this, and on line 21, just say if a court grants the petition in cases of immediate risk of injury to others, blah blah blah, and just continue right on. That way, we're making it clear that if the only sense of harm, and it can be very immediate, where the court would issue it, but in those cases that for maybe mental health reasons. And I would think the mental health professional treatment community would probably be supportive of not having those up there, too, because it might help people not be singled out for whatever, maybe a temporary traumatic event they were going through, but have it up there for good. So I'm empathetic with Representative Ledoux's position on this.
Representative Clayman.
Ms. Mead, just a question on what's on CourtView. Are involuntary commitments under Title 47 posted on CourtView today?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, they are not.
Follow-up? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So I'm following up on one of the questions asked a short while ago, and I'm thinking of a situation where you have an individual who's known to be depressed and suicidal certain times of the year, maybe at Christmas because, you know, they lost a loved one that week or something of that nature. And I'm trying to figure out if I know that someone is going to be in a bad way for a specific period of time, and it hasn't happened yet, but we know it's coming. How would the court respond to that kind of situation here? I'm looking at whether or not first that would go under 815 or 820. If it's 820 and they're known to be a dangerous individual, but not yet, you know, maybe it's only October, it's not December yet, would the court, you know, entertain an 820 in that kind of situation? Or would they say, no, that's got to go the 815 route?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the person files whatever protective order they want. As they can check a box and just ask for an ex parte. They can just ask for the long-term six-month one, or very typically they ask for both. And at least in the domestic violence situation, it's not uncommon for the court to say, I'm not going to grant the ex parte because I don't think you need it within the next 20 days. However, I'll hold it over for the hearing on the long term. And in 2 weeks or 19 days, we'll have the long term hearing. The respondent then will be there. It'll be a full due process hearing, and we can work out whether you need it for the next 6 months. But the ex parte hearings are looked at with the knowledge that being ex parte and one party not there, they have to think, the judicial officer has to think of all the consequences and ramifications of granting one of those in the absence of one of the parties. And if they aren't needed within the next 20 days, I would say that it's not err on the side, but they would make the determination to wait until the long term. So if you come in October and say, I need a short-term one because he might have a problem in December, I can imagine in that situation the court would say, no, you don't need the ex parte, but let's set a long-term one because that seems like the appropriate situation for you.
So let's say we go the 815 route, and we know that during the week of Christmas it's going to be very bad, and maybe this individual crosses the threshold and becomes a dangerous individual. So what discretion does the court have in that type of situation under this bill if the court wants to only make it for a particular week rather than for 6 months, for example, doesn't think that's needed? Does the court have the discretion to just set that time?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the wording of this bill says that the protective order expires 6 months after it's issued unless dismissed earlier by the court at the request of the peace officer or the respondent, and if requested, a hearing. So in that sort of situation, I imagine and feel certain that a judicial officer would say, I do have concerns about this week, but let's look at this again at some point, you know, on January 6th, and determine whether this needs to stay in effect.
And final follow-up?
Final follow-up.
Thank you. So if the court then decides at the end of the week that there's no longer a need for any additional time, but that person did receive an 815 and it did last for 7 days, so I assume from this amendment then that person's name would be going up on CourtView. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, yes, this amendment tells us to post it once the order is issued. That would be a long-term order, and it would be posted.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, Representative Eastman, do you maintain your objection to Amendment Number 1?
I do.
Okay. Representative Ledoux, do you have a question?
Well, it's not exactly a question, but I was thinking about maybe amending amendment number one in line with the suggestion of Representative Kopp, who had some language, I think.
Representative Kopp, do you have language?
Do you have language? Yeah,
on the spot.
Well, on the spot, on line 20, so this is, again, adding one more situation where the court may not publish a court record. So it would read, the Alaska court system may not publish a court record of a gun violence protective order under 815 or 820 unless the court grants a petition under 1865-815 for a respondent who is determined to be dangerous to others. And then semicolon, if the court grants the petition. In that way, we're putting it right in there. It couldn't be misread that we're not talking about self-harm. And the reason we put dangerous to others is when you look at the definition for dangerous individual, an individual is considered dangerous if the individual represents an immediate risk of personal injury to self or others. So I think in that few words, it would direct the court that if the gun violence protective order was issued because of a self-harm threat, that it's not going up.
Thank you, Representative Kopp, Representative Ledoux, Representative Klayman. I guess the question I would pose also is, we can proceed down the conceptual amendment path, or if you choose, we could potentially hold amendment number one to redraft, given that we're not going to get to all amendments tonight.
I just had a question for the court system representative. Is an amendment such as they're proposing even manageable for the court system? It doesn't sound like you're accustomed to digging into the details of any particular order before deciding what goes up and what doesn't go up.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, that's correct. The decision of posting on CourtView is made by a IS clerical person who just looks at a case number and knows, okay, this gets posted 10 days later. If with that amendment, it would cause somebody to have to go and open the file, and that is not something that I don't know that we could do, and it might take, I don't know if it would take money, I don't know how many of these things there are going to be, but it is not something that we've ever done before, and I do think it would be a bit of a problem.
Follow up? Representative Stutz.
Thank you. Through the chair, it sounds to me like if, in fact, that were even a have somebody reading almost every case, which would bring on a huge fiscal note.
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, I'm afraid that might be the case. And again, I don't know how many of these there will be, but if a judge in Barrow has the paper file and the clerk in Anchorage and admin sees, oh, an 815 was issued, I'm supposed to post it, there's nothing on CourtView that indicates the facts of the case. Again, it's just a docket sheet. So I'd really have to think about how that could possibly be accomplished.
So they're posted through Anchorage, it sounds like, basically, and they have no way of telling by the information they receive that they use to do the posting. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, that's correct. I mean, there could be some solution, like you could have an 815 orders are for suicide and 817 order. You know, you could add a new thing so that our clerks know only if it's an 815 do I post it. The suicide ones are separate, a whole separate proceeding from the danger to other ones. Now, that's maybe a complication that's too much. If it were like that, I can see our clerks having just the checkbox, 815s we post, 817s never, or something like that. And I'm speaking just having thought of this for just a few minutes, to be clear.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
Yeah, you could stick right on the form. Danger to self, check. That doesn't go in. Oh. Danger to others, check. That goes in.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's indeed on the form. However, it's not in court view. The forms, you do not see a picture of the petition or anything on court view.
I understand that, but when the clerk is deciding what to input into CourtView, what is so difficult about looking at, you know, this form that I guess could be created that says danger to self. This does not go in. Big bold letters. Danger to others. This does go in.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. I mean, I think I don't want to sound like I'm putting up roadblocks. I truly don't. I think the risk of problems with that is bigger than you might be imagining. When there are 42 different court locations and hundreds of people inputting things in court view, we want to keep it mechanized to minimize the potential for errors. We don't have a auditing function with court view, and if there's something that they can write a computer script and make it work, then we have confidence in what we're posting. But if somebody has to, even in that my scenario, the Barrow clerk has to go and figure out what box to check and then somehow get that to the that factual matter as opposed to just a statute to the IS department in Anchorage who takes things off court view, etc. I anticipate some problems with it at this point.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Mead, so just going to the domestic violence protective orders, you know how it's just to check the box for the judges, and they make their findings, and there's only like one little paragraph where there's extra stuff they write in there as far as you'll also maybe take this and this or help the victim with that. You're familiar with that form I'm talking
through
about?
Through the chair, I'm familiar with that form, Representative Kopp.
Okay. Okay, so what I'm suggesting is, do you think the court... We already have domestic violence protective orders, so we could make a little form for a gun violence protective order, and the findings would be first check boxes, immediate risk of serious injury to self, immediate risk of serious injury to others, and something that would be, you know, that would be user-friendly and readily ascertainable for a judge to know, and the court to know whether that would be postable or not, court view.
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, we absolutely intend to make a form like this should this bill pass. We will make forms that are similar and on the same reading level, for example, as the domestic violence protective orders, which are very simple to understand because those pieces of paper are taken by law enforcement and served on the respondent. So, yes, the respondent will know. The issue is how that fact gets inputted to court view. Court view doesn't have fields for typing factual things. You need a modification to court view, which is not just Excel that you can type anything you want in, for you to add different factors or different considerations. So what it does have a field for is the statute. So we would be able to make 1865-820 orders issued. And again, if there was an 817 order that was different, a danger to self order or a danger to, you know, a suicide danger order, then we could do it. That would take rewriting of the bill, however. But with one order covering two different possible scenarios, CourtView can't distinguish as a database that doesn't have open fields for typing things in what is what, even though the paper will.
Thank you.
Representative Clayman, want to pause and your thoughts on...
I mean, my general perspective is that this is an amendment. The question that this amendment raises really is on page 10, lines 16 through 18, this amendment came about because there's a section that says that court shall not publish an order under 820, which is the ex parte orders. And the court system came and raised questions because they thought this particular language was ambiguous and needed clarity. And the question that this amendment raises is not the grand issues of court view, which we have debated on this committee periodically. And all the time we go down that rabbit hole, we discover that court view is complicated. A lot of people are unhappy with some of the stuff on court view. Court view does not provide the depth of information that some people would like to think. And the more you try to direct the clerks how to do things in court view, you're actually inviting errors, inviting people being incredibly unhappy because some clerk in the courthouse made a mistake. And I think the only question that's before us here is, does the committee prefer subsection B on page 10 as what gives the court direction, or would they rather have the increased clarity that comes with amendment number one? And I think that's really the only question that we should be deciding if the committee wants to try to go down the rabbit hole of court view
and re-explore all the policy of court view, I would suggest that that may be dilatory in terms of this particular bill. But if the committee wants to spend more time on court view, then we shouldn't finish this amendment. But if really the committee wants to decide which of these two languages to use, we should vote up the amendment and move on to the next.
Representative Ledoux. Well,
I guess my thought is that I think this is kind of important. And I'm not ready to pass a bill that is going to put people who have, where there's a protective order, and it's a suicide protective order. I'm not willing to post that on court view. And if this bill is going to post those things on court view, then I have some real problems with that bill.
My read is there's probably not the votes to pursue with Amendment Number 1 as written. So I would suggest we set it aside and proceed to Amendment Number 2.
There's not the votes, vote it down.
Okay. that's an option.
Or you want? It's your choice. Set it.
I'm gonna set Amendment Number 1 aside. And we're gonna proceed to Amendment Number 2.
Move Amendment Number 2.
I will object to Amendment Number 2 for purposes of discussion. Representative Klayman.
Amendment Number 2 was in response to concerns that were raised by the troopers in the Department of Public Safety that the language that was drafted and in the CS to this part of the bill, that the distinction between an officer that's serving an ex parte order to seize a weapon, and if the respondent refuses to turn over the weapon, there was concern that that language, public safety thought it might actually lead to the officers thinking they had to wait for 48 hours after giving notice to that they were going to seize the weapon, that they had to come back later. Public safety said this was actually going to create a significant increased risk to officers, and they wanted the language to be really clear that if the officer serves the ex parte order and the respondent refuses to turn over the guns, in the same way in a domestic violence protective situation, that if the respondent refuses to leave the house, they can be arrested for failure to follow the order. In the same sense here, if the individual said, I'm not going to turn over my gun, that refusal would be a basis for arresting that individual. So this was at the request of the Department of Public Safety and very focused on officer safety. And it actually doesn't change the intent of the language in the bill. What it does is it makes it abundantly clear when the respondent, when the officer has the authority to take the weapon on refusal to comply with the ex parte order.
Questions on Amendment Number 2, Representative Ledoux.
I guess I'm just wondering when the ex parte protective order is issued, is there going to be, is the court going to set forth exactly what guns are going to be seized? Or does the person who, does the police officer get to search the house for guns? Because how are you going to figure out, you know, if somebody has 5 guns, but he turns over 4 guns? I guess I'm just wondering there.
Representative Klayman.
Representative Ledoux, I'm finding the language in the bill.
So I can help, Mr. Chairman.
I'll let Representative Kopp.
Representative Kopp.
Yeah, so I guess first that this amendment deals with just the long-term protective order. So after the court, the person in a long term has been given 10 days notice, come to court, have your hearing, you know, present your case. The judge makes a ruling on the clear and convincing standard and says that, that's when the 48 hours comes in. Because there's obviously not the extreme urgency because nobody has arrested this person, brought him to court. They've, in those cases. Now, the reality is that most of these will be ex parte, where it's not just a starting with a 6-month order. You're actually starting with an ex parte emergency. The court makes a finding, based on probable cause, that there is a dangerous individual and the person is dangerous by possessing a firearm, either to themselves or others, depending on what they find. So the officer shows up, and what public safety was saying, and Representative Clayman can help me with my memory, but is that in those circumstances, they don't want to have to come back 48 hours later on an ex parte, because if it truly is such an emergency that the court has said yes, go intervene right now before something bad happens. For them to say within 48 hours you must do these things, number one, it truly can't have been that big of an emergency to begin with, and two, law enforcement is going to have to come back in a very high-risk situation to make sure those guns were, in fact, either sold or given to an authorized third party or whatever we have, you know, have in the bill that allows them to. But that's very risky for law enforcement to have to come back a second time when the person knows, if they haven't already complied, they know the police will be showing back up, and it puts the public and particularly the police in a tough spot. So my memory is that they just want to be able to, on an ex parte, take the guns at the same time to prevent a second trip, and at that time give notice to the person saying your hearing's in 10 days, and the judge will decide if we're to retain these or give them right back to you. So.
And so Representative Ledoux, actually, the question you asked was the guns, what do they have to surrender? And if you look on page 4, lines 2 through 4 of the bill, which is not what this amendment addresses, it states the petition shall describe the number, types, and locations of any firearms or ammunition the officer believes are owned or possessed by the respondent. So the officer basically describes what guns he thinks they have. And then if you turn to page 6 and the first few lines on line 19 and going forth, the court shall order the respondent to surrender to the appropriate law enforcement agency, etc., all firearms and ammunition that the respondent possesses. So what the order would require would be the surrender of all firearms.
Representative Ledoux.
Okay, so I guess I'm just trying to figure this thing out. So ex parte can only be gotten by a peace officer, correct?
Yes. Actually, these only orders, both ex parte and contested, can only be gotten by a police officer.
By a police officer.
Private individuals cannot apply.
Okay. So how does this police officer, I mean, for example, somebody's putting up threatening things on Facebook. I'm just trying to figure this out in my own mind. So you've got some, guy putting up nutsy things on Facebook. And so somebody reports this, Mr. X is putting up nutsy things on Facebook. He seems really dangerous. How does, unless the guy has itemized his gun inventory on Facebook, how does the police officer know what guns he's got?
Representative Clayman?
Well, Representative Ledoux, to some extent, he may not, and it may be that the police officer goes and uses their best efforts on serving an ex parte order and may, in fact, not collect every gun that the individual has. They come with an order that says turn over all the guns you possess, and at some point you can't. If somebody's got three guns hidden in the basement and says, doesn't say anything about where they're hidden, the officer probably won't find them and he probably won't tell them about them. But you can't legislate people to be honest. This particular amendment is more specific to the making it clear in section 1865.830, the procedures that would occur when they serve an ex parte protective order and what happens if they don't comply with the officer's instructions.
Representative Kopp, further elaboration?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the ex parte gun violence protective orders, if the guns have not already been seized, such as would occur if something happened in the presence of a peace officer and due to the emergency of the situation. They grabbed the handgun on the counter, whatever, and left. But if that didn't happen, and now they're coming back, based on this finding of ex parte, they will have a search warrant with them. And if you look at page 5 of the bill, on lines 18, 19, and 20, it says, if the peace officer has not seized the firearms before filing an ex parte gun violence order under this section, the peace officer shall also request a search warrant to search for and seize any firearms in the possession of the respondent. And the court shall grant the request for a search warrant if the officer, judicial officer, determines there is probable cause to believe the respondent is a dangerous individual possession of a firearm. There, law enforcement does not want to be faced going into a house without a search warrant. And there you have to particularly describe the thing that you're looking for, the place where you're looking for it. So they won't get it unless they can convince the court that they actually believe there are guns in the house and can convince the court that that a search warrant is necessary to get them. And also, I would point out that they also have to, prior to this, convince the court that less restrictive alternatives have been tried and were ineffective. That's on lines 4 and 5. So just to help with how that process would work in that situation.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
So I'm likewise trying to get my head around what's going on here, and it seemed we made quite a jump from, and we have all sorts of language in the bill about, you know, surrendering peace, weapons and ammunition and so forth, and we quickly jumped to, you know, it's the responsibility of law enforcement to confiscate firearms. And I'm wondering, with the language you're talking about, the court shall grant the request for a search warrant. Are there any sidebars on that? If I, as a peace officer, get this protective order and I'm requesting a search warrant, I mean, normally it would be up to the judge to say, you know, hey, that's way too vague. You know, you can't search the guy's whole 1,000 acres or, you know, that's unreasonable or whatever. And yet here we're just saying, you know, whatever I write down, basically the court's just supposed to approve it? Am I missing something here?
Representative Clemon?
No, the court is not just supposed to approve it. The court has to make specific findings, like they would with any search warrant, that there's probable cause to believe that, A, the person is a dangerous individual, and, B, that they have weapons. And that's the standard probable cause finding the court makes in any circumstance like this. I would note, however, Mr. Chair, that the questions about these functions are actually way beyond the scope of this amendment. This amendment is actually very limited to trying to create clarity about what happens when an officer serves the orders. And the substance of the orders we've actually discussed extensively in prior hearings, and this, again, appears to be taking off the task of Amendment Number 2.
Point well taken. Representative Eastman, maybe one further question, and then we'll return strictly to the substance of Amendment Number 2.
So I'm still trying to understand the substance of 2, which is why we are asking these questions, Mr. Chairman. So I'm just trying to understand, and to anyone who can help me get clarity. So with this amendment, and I'm looking at the language here, if firearms haven't already been confiscated, they can be seized. So, but that seems different than a responsibility of law enforcement to kind of proactively, you know, seize weapons. I mean, okay, they may be seized. Got it. If he's wearing it on his hip holster or whatever, I seize it. Okay, got it. That makes sense. But if I don't see it, I'm trying to figure out what my responsibility is at that point. If I say, hey, you know, here's your protective order, and I give him the piece of paper, and he says, you know, thanks for coming by, officer. I can't even remember having any weapons or where they are or whatnot. In any case, I don't surrender any weapons. What is the responsibility of law enforcement at that point, you know, under this language amendment?
Representative Clemon.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll direct
rather than, I think Representative Eastman is actually pretty far afield from the topic of this particular amendment. If you look at the language in the bill on page 6 and look in subsection A, starting on line 24 and continue to line 26, there was confusion about the sequence that would occur because this second sentence, if the respondent's firearms have not already been seized, a peace officer may seize any firearms in the possession, custody, control of the respondent when the peace officer delivers an ex parte protective order issued under AS 1865-820 to the respondent. The law enforcement agencies explained that because the immediately following in reference in subsection B talked about within 48 hours, law enforcement agencies believed this language was confusing and wanted clarity. And so if you look at amendment number 2, what's happened is the first five lines are basically creating new subsection A, which is based on the language in that last sentence of the existing subsection A, or the subsection A in the bill, that clarifies if there's an ex parte being served and the firearms have not already been seized, they may seize any firearms in the possession custody when they deliver the ex parte protective order, and that gives the officer the basis to say, I need your guns, and if the person refuses to turn them over, that would be a basis to arrest that person. And then the remainder, what was now subsection A in the first sentence will become subsection B, and that becomes the circumstance under which they're serving the order after there'd been a contested hearing. And there's not the situation of officer safety involved. So this is specifically a situation where an officer is serving an order consistent with what Representative Kopp has described on page 5 in section B, that they will have a search warrant to seize any firearms in the possession of the respondent. This is to clarify that the failure to comply with that order gives the officer a basis to arrest somebody for noncompliance, and if there's compliance, then, or if it's a not an ex parte situation, then there's more time allowed to surrender the weapons.
Thank you. Representative Kopp.
Yeah, I would note also on line 3 of the amendment there, it says a peace officer may seize any firearms in the possession. So that's in the permissive rather than shell, but it certainly makes it clear that there is legal authority should the context of that service indicate that seizure of firearms should occur. And again, this is only based on an ex parte. So you're showing up, you're serving notice of the ex parte order, there is an immediacy, and you have a search warrant in hand. If you have a search warrant, you're probably going to be seizing. If for some reason you don't, it's hard to imagine all the circumstances. If you don't, that word may is very important there. That may you would not. But you will certainly be giving them the notice of when their hearing is. So, or frankly, they just simply may not have any firearms in their possession. You ask them, they say no, and the circumstances indicate that there probably is not. So,
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm looking at, if we adopt this language, and from what I'm hearing from other committee members, it really seems like this whole 48 hours language on line 24 is kind of moot. We have a situation where we're going to serve notice to this person, and on line 24 we're saying that they have, 48 hours to go ahead and do what they're going to do, but we're going to bring a search warrant, and if they don't turn over their guns, we're going to arrest that person. This seems to be in conflict with the 48 hours. Can someone resolve that conflict for me?
Representative Eastman, it's another, if you look at lines 10, 11, and 12 of the amendment, it makes it shows that the sections that apply to the 48 hours are actually the order under section 815, which is the contested protective order, and orders under 825, which are modification of the orders. And so the section with the 48 hours does not apply to the ex parte orders, which would, as amended, only apply to subsection A. So subsection A of this section would relate to ex parte orders. Subsection B would relate to the contested orders and the modification of the orders in the 48 hours and what would become subsection C would only relate to the orders that were issued either under the contested situation or modifications thereof.
Thank you.
I'm going to withdraw my objection to amendment number two.
I'm going to object.
Okay.
And
Representative Reingold, would you like to speak to your objection?
So basically, the amendment says when a court issues an ex parte, so that's without due process for the people listening, gun violence protective order under AS 1865-820, if the respondent's firearms have not already been seized, a peace officer may seize any firearm in the possession, custody, or control of the respondent when the peace officer delivers the ex parte protective order to the respondent. So what I'm asking is it has not already, when was the opportunity to confiscate in the first place? It sounds like there's two different opportunities. I just need clarification.
Representative Klayman.
I thought we were debating the motion, but Representative Reingold, if you turn to section 1235-200 on page 2, the bill specifically provides when an officer is confronted or faces a dangerous individual and believes there's an immediate danger that needs immediate action, they have authority both under this statute and under existing common law to seize the weapons and to prevent the dangerous situation from getting to be a problem where somebody is severely injured or killed. And so the bill provides when an officer performs a warrantless seizure such as this, then the officer has a duty within 72 hours to actually file the paperwork to explain the reasons for the warrantless seizure, which is the way of providing more due process for an individual that has their weapons seized than they would have today under existing authority to seize weapons in a variety of circumstances.
So,
Representative Reingold.
So it says seize any firearm in the possession, custody, or control. Can this mean a parent's house? Can this be at work? Could this be at a cabin? Could this be at a house in the lower 48? I mean, to me, this is pretty broad. I want to know when they, you know, if they're already taking a firearm without due process, it's an ex parte order, and now it says anything in their possession, custody, or control. I want to know, does this allow the peace officer to go any place where this person owns? A lodge?
Vice Tompkins, this is, again, well beyond the scope of this particular amendment.
No, it's
We're
not.
Really referring to the sections in subsection B on page 5. Regarding the search warrant that they would offer for the search and seizure any firearms in the possession of the respondent. And it's well established under search and seizure law that warrant would have to identify the places to be searched and the things to be seized. And so it wouldn't give any officer broad authority to wander the streets and look for anything anywhere. They would actually have a very specific place, and a warrant that didn't provide that degree of specificity would be subject to significant court challenge. And frankly, that can't imagine any judge in this state or any other that would issue such a warrant. And finally, with regard to out-of-state properties, the jurisdiction of this court, the state courts do not extend to other states.
We have a motion on the table.
Well, I think we're still discussing it. We're still discussing it.
I objected, so.
Representative Ledoux?
So, again, I'm just trying to wrap my arms around this thing. So, if the peace officer recognizes that there is a dangerous individual, that peace officer can, without the judge giving him authority to do so, just take the gun, correct?
Representative Reingold, I mean Representative Ledoux, that's correct. That's what we've discussed earlier, and that's the case. And they can do that today under a variety of circumstances.
Okay. So then they go to the court afterwards.
Well, Representative Ledoux, they go to the court afterwards, but in terms of Amendment Number 2, that regards the situation when the firearms have not already been seized. There's a gun violence protective order, and here this is giving the officer the authority to seize the weapons if they hadn't already been seized. That's correct.
So how does this change it from what's on page 6 already?
The difference between this and page 6 is not changing the substance. It's clarifying because the Department of Public Safety was concerned that the way it was drafted on page 6 and the placement of the second sentence of subsection A on page 6 in the same paragraph as the portions in the first sentence of subsection A.
Which?
If you look on page 6, we've actually been through this before, Representative Ledoux. The second sentence that reads, if the respondent's firearms have not already been seized, a peace officer may seize any firearm in the possession, control, or custody of the respondent when the peace officer delivers an ex parte protective order issued under 16-65-820, which is the ex parte provisions. And if you compare that language to what will become subsection A on Amendment Number 2, and this is what I've been over before with Representative Eastman, that becomes subsection A, and that relates to what happens when they serve an ex parte order. The Department of Public Safety indicated by combining the first sentence of subsection A on page 6, which merged in together section 815, section 820, and section 825 in one sentence, they felt that was confusing and raised issues about whether or not they could immediately seize the weapons. So at the request of the Department of Public Safety, this amendment is simply intended to clarify the language that's already on page 6 so that law enforcement isn't confused and a person reading the statute after it's amended will understand the sequence. This is changing nothing of the substance of the bill.
Well, maybe law enforcement isn't confused right now, but I'm confused.
Yeah, so I got a comment.
Representative Eastman, hold on.
I'm just not following this.
Let me try to summarize because I want to make sure I myself understand it. Effectively, what Amendment Number 2 does is it takes the second sentence of the current section 1865A30A and breaks it off as its own subsection,
right,
for the purposes of clarity.
Yes.
I want to go to you, Representative Kopp, because often you help clarify things. Do you have a clarifying comment?
Yes, I think I do. First of all, this is complicated legal process for lay legislators who don't normally deal with domestic violence protective orders and how they're tiered. And so I think, we should expect questions about how this all works. I just wanted to say, Representative Reinbold brought up a good question about warrantless seizure of firearms. How does that work? And I just wanted to give a classic example for the committee to how this normally works is you get a call 11, 12 o'clock at night, 1 in the morning, from a concerned family member that says, my adult son is very depressed. He hasn't come out of his room. He's talking about killing himself. Can you come help talk to him? This happens regularly. Situations like this. So you show up at the house and you knock on the door and please, I'm here because your mom called or your dad called. And they may or not on the door, so you're talking through a closed door, hoping they're not armed and hoping they're not mad that you're there. And you'd get a dialogue going, and are you going to hurt yourself? Well, I'm thinking about it. Do you have a gun? Yes. And after a dialogue, the goal is to talk them not into hurting themselves or you, and that you talk them into turning over the gun that night until they feel better the next day. And that would be a warrantless seizure. And that's a classic example of how law enforcement goes home. Now, right now, there is no process for that person to get the gun back unless the officer is required to make a report of it right away because he's dealing with a mental health situation. And that would have to be logged into evidence and all that. But right now, there's no process other than maybe the DA or the police chief saying the person's probably fine to get their gun back. So this bill actually says within 72 hours you have to have done your affidavit to the court, and the court has to rule on whether you were right to take it, retain it, or you need to give it back. So right now, there while it happens routinely that, I shouldn't say routinely, but while it does happen that law enforcement will take guns for safekeeping on under those circumstances where people are at risk to harm themselves, there really is not a process in the law for helping the gun owner actually get their gun back and for judicial oversight in those situations. So that's under the warrantless end. And then, of course, on the ex parte end is where you get that same call and that there is, you know, my son is saying he's going to go and shoot up the neighbor's house, or and I'm really concerned. And it just happens to be that for various reasons, you swing by the courthouse and you say, Judge, I just got this report. Here's the statement of the mom. And I want a, you know, I would like an ex parte order to go in and try to prevent this person from going to shoot up the neighbor's house. And by the way, I'd also like a search warrant because mom says he does have a .22 long rifle and that she has said he's made these threats before and she thinks he's serious this time. So the judge agrees with you and says, okay, you have the statement from the mom. You believe it's correct. Mr. Officer, I'm going to give you the ex parte and the search warrant. So then you show up with your ex parte, serve it on the son, the search warrant to get the firearm right then, and you give him notice saying in 10 days you're going to have a hearing on this issue, and the judge will determine if you can, you know, get your gun back or not. And then the standard is clear and convincing evidence, whether it should be retained or not. If the judge says, no, you're still a danger at that time of the hearing, not when the firearm was taken, but at the time, then it's going to go to a six-month protective order. Or it can be, as Ms. Mead pointed out, the court can terminate it earlier if the court chooses on petition of the officer or the respondent and a request for hearing is made. So that is kind of an example of how that warrantless seizure works, how the ex parte search warrant works together, and how it eventually may work into a long-term six-month order. But I think the fact that the committee is tired and we don't deal with these all the time, it's not a surprise that it's we get a little muddied on the process. I do wish we had someone from Department of Public Safety to talk us through some of these things. But.
Thank you, Representative Kropp. I think because this is effectively simply reordering effectively sentences in the bill and the scope, I think, as expressed, is pretty limited. I'm going to move to committee discussion. We can take a vote the amendment up or down, and then move forward from there. So
I had a couple questions.
We're going to move to discussion, I think, at this point, and move through amendment number two. And
okay, well, can we just get him on record then saying yes or no? I mean, if we want to rush this, I can put it as a yes or no question.
Yeah, you can pose any questions you want, and Representative Klayman can speak to those questions when we go through committee comment. Committee comment on amendment number two. I'm going to give 2 minutes to each member. Who would like to first comment on amendment number two?
Well, I'm still trying to clarify here.
Sure.
And the reason I've been trying to clarify is because I think the real substance of the amendment is probably lines 11 and 12. And I'll concede that the way it's laid out on the pages makes it a little bit difficult to see that. But on 11 and 12, we're making the switch, which is page 6, line 20 of the bill, and we are pulling out the ex parte from that, and that is a substantive change. That's not a reordering or, you know, rephrasing. And I think that kind of is the issue here, if I can summarize it that way. We're making it clear for purposes of the rest of the bill that the ex parte protective order is not going to fall under this same provision here on line 20.
Thank you, Representative Eastman.
Before I make my wrap-up comments, I think it's so important that, first of all, we talk about the Second Amendment here. It says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Let me recognize you if you'd like to make your comment. Would you like
I thought you did. You shook your head.
I know I haven't recognized you. Would you like to make your comment?
Well, of course, but it says...
Representative Reinbold, 2 minutes on Amendment number two.
Okay, first of all, you're rushing this. It's 9 o'clock at night. We're all here working. This is my 14th hour, and I find this outrageous that you're trying when the right there, if the
order,
Constitution.
Speaking to the amendment.
I am speaking to the amendment.
Representative Reinbold, I'll give you your 2 minutes.
Okay, so it says, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. We swore to uphold and defend the Constitution as you did. We are That's no duplicate. So if you look at the other amendments, you're not allowed to do this. So the bottom line is, we're rushing something that is in complete violation if you swear to uphold and defend the Constitution. I don't know what it says. It says to seize any... I don't know if that means your office. I don't know if that means your mother's house. I don't know what it means when you can search and seize warrantlessly as long as it's in their possession, custody, or control. I think it's very important that we know exactly what that means, because if it's in your custody, it could be in a lodge, it could be in your office, or if it's under your control. I think this is an extremely broad. You can say all you want that it's simple and you can try to rush this, but I think this is very, very serious, and I think it's wrong to be rushing something that is so absolutely critical to what holds this nation together.
Thank you, Representative Reinbold. Further comment on amendment number 2? Representative Kopp.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, well, I certainly agree with Representative Reinvold's passionate words of caution in protecting our Second Amendment, and I think we do need to be careful as we go through this. I would say that we're not talking about warrantless searches. We're talking about warrantless seizures, and those can only happen when the nature of the circumstance demands an immediate response based on what you are immediately observing, the danger. So in the case where you have someone saying, yes, I am thinking about killing myself, and they're actually holding the gun, that is when you actually do your best, if you care about the person and the circumstance, to talk them out of it and to let you take it with them. That would be a warrantless seizure, albeit 99% of the time it is voluntary. You could also imagine a situation where you have a jumper on a bridge or somebody who you're talking away from a situation. Those people also can be prepared to end their lives in more than one way. They may also be armed. And so in the process of talking them back and getting them into a safe spot, you may do a warrantless seizure of a weapon that they have threatened to take their life with. So, but not a search. A search always requires a warrant, and if you making a search without a warrant, the courts frown upon that, and Representative Reinbold is ready to point that out. There are very narrow sets of circumstances when that may be permissible, but they are very rare, and on searches, you need a warrant. So.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, you know, I understand where Representative Reinbold is coming from, and I sympathize and concur with her comments about the Second Amendment. But with or without, I mean, even if we don't do this amendment, the bill in itself uses the term basically possession, custody, or control. So I guess I'm sort of thinking that I'm probably going to vote for the amendment, but then when we come back to the bill, I still have some concerns about the bill, with or without this amendment in it. But I can understand where the public safety officers are coming from. So I'm going to support this amendment, but that doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to support the bill.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. Representative Reinbold, do you maintain your objection?
Yes, I do. And is he going to answer my question?
Yes, I'm sorry. In wrap-up, Representative Klayman.
I did want to say something. I haven't had a chance to take a position.
Actually, he did. He was the first person to speak.
I was offered a clarifying comment.
You were the first comment, Representative Eastman, that
I
recognized.
Can I finish the rest of the 2 minutes then?
I think we've already passed over you. I'm sorry. I'm going to offer Representative Klayman the opportunity to respond to points
point of
that
order.
You raised and Representative Reinbold raised. Yes, Representative
point
Reinbold,
of order. There's
point
two
of order.
Points of order. It says when you rush, there's often unfairness. And two, you have to have equality for members, and he's being denied. He had a point of clarity, which is much different than discussion.
Representative Reinbold, I opened up with 2 minutes of comments for each person and recognized Representative Eastman first of all the members. So at this point, in the spirit of equality, I'm going to offer Representative Klayman the sponsor of the amendment 2 minutes, as everyone else had, to include and to speak to any questions that were raised by other members.
I'd offer a point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Eastman.
I was simply, as you know, my hand was raised for quite some time, and I was passed over several times before you determined that my next statement was going to be my two-minute wrap-up, and I think that was inappropriate.
Noted, Representative Eastman. Representative Klayman.
So Representative Eastman asked a question or made a comment and asked questions about clarity. In fact, Representative Eastman's comments was actually mistaken in reading the amendment and the bill. The bill does not remove the ex parte provisions. The bill on lines, or the amendment on lines 10 through 12, simply take out, as I think, Mr. Chair, you recognize, it takes the second sentence of the bill on subsection A and makes it a separate section. So the ex parte provisions are retained, but they're put in a subsection of their own, and then subsection B addresses the non-ex parte situation. And the whole purpose of this amendment is not to debate the merits or demerits of ex parte orders, but to make the language of the bill very clear and more easily understood, and so there's not confusion. It doesn't change the substance of it at all, and I think Representative Ledoux was right on target. The question for this amendment is not, do you support the bill? If you may or may not support the bill, the question that one should be asking is, does this amendment make the language on page 6, starting at line 19, does it make that language, is it a better way to draft that language so it can be more easily understood by police officers and court officers? And it does. And for those reasons, I would urge a yes vote on the amendment. And with respect to questions from Representative Reinbold, I agree with her comments about we must be very careful about protecting Second Amendment rights, but I never heard her ask a question.
Okay. Point of order.
Representative Reinbold, do you have another
question? Section 85. Says that we have the fundamental right to know the intended and unintended consequences before we vote. What my question is it intention that they don't go and search lodges, businesses, homes, etc.? It's only where that person is residing at that time. That's my question, yes or no.
Representative Reinbold, I think Representative Klayman's made clear what he sees as the intended consequences of Amendment Number 2, so at this time we're going to proceed to a vote. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Christ Tompkins?
Yes.
Representative Eastman?
Pass.
Representative Reinbold?
No.
Representative Kopp?
Yes.
Representative Stutes?
Yes.
Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
Representative Eastman?
No.
Chair Klayman?
Yes.
5 yea, 2 nay.
By a vote of 5 yeas and 2 yeas, Amendment Number 2, excuse me, passes, and at this time I'm going to pass the gavel back to Chair Klayman.
So at this time we're going to adjourn for the evening. We will come back to Judiciary on Monday. I would note there have been a lot of questions about how this bill operates that didn't relate, in my view, to the amendment. I will be in Juneau all weekend. I'll be available for those that would like some assistance in understanding how the bill works. I would encourage you to contact me, and I'll be happy to spend time walking through the bill to the extent you need assistance in understanding the process and how it works, which may help us move a little more expeditiously through the coming amendments. And with that, we will stand adjourned. Hold on, let me check my scripts. With that, we will stand adjourned. It is now 9:01 p.m.